Did we have a
like to call to order the House Committee on Judiciary Policy and Finance Committee Assistant, take the roll, please.
Chairman Smith.
Here.
Vice Chair Shemansky.
Present.
Representative Johnson.
Here.
Representative Anderson.
Here.
Representative Champion.
Here.
Representative Cornish.
Here.
Representative Grunhagen.
Here.
Representative Hillstrom.
Here.
Representative Creasel. Representative Lane. Representative Lesh.
Here.
Representative Newman.
Here.
Representative Mazzaro.
Here.
Representative Moline.
Here.
Representative Schumacher.
Here.
Representative Vogel.
Present.
Representative Wardlow.
Chair notes that we do have a quorum present, so we'll get right to the agenda. First item is considering the minutes from May 4, 2011. They're in the packet. Can I have a motion on those?
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Shemansky moves approval of the May 4, 2011 minutes. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Members, it's the intention of the chair to complete our agenda this morning. We have all morning, I believe. Also, we have this room reserved until noon, therefore, we're going to get through our agenda. We will take a brief break at 10 o'clock. Additionally, we have this room tomorrow at 1 o'clock, so if we do have business tomorrow, it will be at 1 o'clock here. Chair would like to now bring forward House File 6 by Representative Cornish. It's back before the committee. We had heard this before. It's intention to move this bill to Ways and Means. Representative Cornish moves House File 6 be recommended to pass and be referred to Ways and Means. Representative Cornish, give us a brief review.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I will give you a brief overview and then get into as much detail as you would like after that. House File 6 is a new way of looking and dealing with sex offenders, both on the way in and on the way out. It basically comes from a lot of conversation with county attorneys, courts, and others in the stakeholder groups. And what this bill does is, on a conviction of criminal sexual conduct in the first, second, or different degrees, instead of the sentence in the way we do now, what we do is have a bifurcated trial. And on the first trial, the defendant, if found guilty, would go to a second stage of the trial where, on a bifurcated trial, where there would be a special classification to see if this person was determined as a predatory sex offender. The reason for this is it's not to carte blanche, throw everybody into treatment, and in this way, receiving the treatment in corrections instead of the SOP, is we're hoping for a future huge cost savings. What it would do is, if they were classified in the second trial as a predatory sexual offender, you'd get a 60-year sentence. And you would be available for a conditional release after serving twice the minimum mandatory, which is about 25 years. So after the second trial, if you're considered a predatory sexual offender under certain criteria that you'd have to meet to get there, you would be given to the Department of Corrections for 60 years. The release authority falls with the commissioner alone, and you would have to meet, again, certain criteria to be eligible for the conditional release. If you violated your conditional release, you would be sent back to the Commissioner of Corrections. And the process is laid out along with the definitions. We're hoping to glean the system better for people that we send up instead of, there's a lot of people arguably that they're now in the SOP program and the civil commitments that shouldn't be. This would help separate the person that is sentenced for what we consider in some terms a statutory rape, or in other words, consensual sex of between people. However, it's still a criminal offense, naturally, and they end up in this program and maybe shouldn't be. There could be a a different conclusion could come about to save us a lot of money. So basically, it's a way to refine who goes in for this expensive treatment, and the people would receive treatment from the Department of Corrections under this bill at a much less cost. I should say that we were considering other alternatives. The effective date of this proposed legislation is out there, and I'm pretty confident that we'll get a sexual offender task force in the meantime, in the interim, between now and the time that this bill would go into effect, where we can meet with the County Attorney's Association, who has been giving a lot of help and guidance in this, along with the people from the Sex Offender Program and others. And this large group that we're going to have consider in the task force could come up with a different idea, and we could be back reforming House File 6. But for now, I'd like to pass House File 6 on to Ways and Means and eventually enact it, and in the interim have the task force and further refine it. So,
Representative Cornish, thank you. Discussion, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish, you have another bill that we heard. I don't know if it was in this committee or in civil law. I get them mixed up sometimes. That actually is supported by the County Attorneys Association that does something different than this. So you said that you'd like to get this enacted into law. Do you want to get the other one enacted into law too, and then you have two conflicting laws on the books? Or I understand that you want to do a study to find out which process or what the right process is, but why do you want to enact this one if you think you're going to change it and you actually have another bill that is conflicting with this?
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, what other bill are you talking about besides House File 6? I know of no other version that's in committee.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, we heard a proposal that did not any longer have a bifurcated trial that the county attorneys came and testified that they'd been working on, that it was an additional process, but it was not, it no longer had the bifurcated trial process.
Representative Hillstrom, are you referring to the DE3 amendment that he is not offering?
Oh, so he's not going to offer the DE3 to the, so it would be to this same bill?
Right.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So why are you not offering the DE3?
Representative Cornish, make it brief.
I decided not to.
That's brief.
Representative Hillstrom. anything else? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, just to finish up what Representative Hillstrom said then, because I was a little bit confused as well, so we do have the, Representative Cornish, you do have the bifurcated trial then? That's correct, as the bill reads here. And we're not replacing with indeterminate sentencing and a review panel. So that's correct.
Representative Cornish.
Is that correct, Representative Cornish?
Go ahead.
That we are doing a bifurcated trial in your bill here.
Could you, Mr. Chair, could you state again your last transmission, over?
Well, I was just trying to follow what we've done in the past. So we are doing the bifurcated trial and not doing the review panel and indeterminate sentencing.
Yes, under this provision, and I just was notified there here that I have to do an amendment to put this effective date out. The original intention was to put the effective date out on this, so I have an amendment. But you're right, we're going with a bifurcated trial in the version you see before you and not with the and with the commissioner being the authority rather than the 60, 40, 50, 30 indeterminate that we had.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish. And is there a fiscal note on this version then? Because I'm sure there'd be a cost to public defenders, an additional cost that would need to be included.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, yes, there is a fiscal note, and that's one of the reasons it's going to Ways and Means.
Well, we just don't have it, Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson, no. Ways and Means will have it.
Mr. Chair, I could add that that we have a lot of input from the county attorneys, and it's just the fact that there's so many ideas right now that I would like to stay at the original version, but the part of the reason for setting the effective date out there and having the task force in between is to get the courts, the public defenders, and the county attorneys, who have all expressed a lot of support for the bill, but they want to see it in a different version. There was really nobody come to the table to say, we're against this bill. They had support for the bill, but they would like to see it in a different version. So there was there was bipartisan support also, as I remember, to move in the direction of what we're going, we're indeterminate sentencing. So what you see here could very likely change over the next year after the task force study. It's just a move in the right direction, I figure.
Any further discussion from the committee? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is it typical that we put a law in place that we know we're going to change while we're working on a study? Don't we usually put the study in place and take their recommendations and then enact into law what we find out from the study?
Representative Cornish.
Well, Representative Hillstrom, in case the task force, like some do, get discombobulated and come up with nothing at all, at least we have something on the books that's moving in the right direction. It's better than the system we have now, and it refines who's going where, and I think it follows the general direction that the legislative auditors report put out. There's too many people going to the program that don't have to be there, and I think even Representative Liebling, my conservative friend, had some support on this bill, at least moving in the right direction. Not satisfied with the end result yet, but we're working on it.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Cornish, I'm disappointed that you're not offering the other amendment, as I think I signed on as a co-author of the other process. I believe I have heard deep concerns from the folks that are going to have to do these bifurcated trials, that bifurcated trials could be a serious problem. I guess I hope that you continue to work with the stakeholders and consider not putting something into the statute that you know is going to be changed.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Cornish, I was going to express some of the same concern as Representative Hillstrom about the process. I actually do like this direction better. And so, you know, you're going to have, obviously this isn't partisan, and, you know, and I do think that I'm really glad that you're working on doing something, because clearly we have to do something different. But I am concerned about putting something into law, and then, because I'm kind of worried about the fail-safe the opposite direction. You know, if we don't really work out the kinks, suddenly we have this law that, you know, while it starts to take people perhaps out of the stream of going toward MSOP, this is, people's lives are impacted and the functioning of the courts may be impacted, and it would impact all kinds of things. So I think this is a great effort on your part, but I feel really uncomfortable passing a bill like this through this committee that's a fiscal committee when we don't know what the fiscal implication might be. And I would much rather see you continue to work on it without putting something into law. And I think there's a lot of momentum behind this, and I certainly would work with you to do something along these lines.
Mr. Chair, I to satisfy your concerns, or at least get there, I have introduced a bill, if you notice, recently that has the DE3 amendment in it. And so I'm thinking the same way you are, and I'm going to work towards that end to, don't get me wrong, I think this is a good bill, and I wouldn't have a problem enacting it, but I'm very willing to look at the changes that both of you have brought up. So.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, Representative Cornish renews. What?
I have to do that oral amendment, put the effective date out. We just noticed that the effective date is...
Okay, state your motion.
If I could have legal staff here show you where the effective date has to be changed. And I would offer that as an oral amendment.
Mr. Chair and members, on page 3, line 26, delete August 1st, 2011, and insert July 1st, 2013.
Okay, without it, if there's no objection, we'll consider that incorporated.
Yeah, I would move that amendment. Or are they just incorporated into the bill?
Yes.
Okay.
Representative Cornish renews his motion that House File 6, as altered this morning, be recommended to pass, be referred to Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you. Representative Woodard, House File 1001. House File 14. 23, excuse me, Gottwald. Jumping ahead, moving a little too fast, Representative Gottwald. Welcome to the committee.
We're new, Mr. Chair.
Now, we heard this bill last week, and it's again before the committee to allow for an agency amendment. The chair moves that House File 1423 be recommended to pass and be re-referred back to Ways and Means. Chair also moves the, so the bill is before us again. Chair moves the A4 amendment. Let's get the bill in the shape we need. Any discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. House File 1423 as amended. We've heard the bill, so let's focus on the amendment. Representative Gottwald.
Mr. Chair, just to refresh members' memories, this is the Department of Human Services Adoption Assistance Reform Bill. And I will turn it over to Christine Borsheim with the Department of Human Services for a presentation of the A4 amendment.
Before you begin, is there anyone in the audience who wants to be heard in testimony on this bill? Raise your hand now. Go ahead.
Good morning. I'm Christine Borsheim with the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Just briefly, an overview of these amendments, that Article 2 is largely related to the reform of the Juvenile Court Act in Chapter 260C. This act covers court processes for children alleged to be in need of protection or services and for whom the agency must petition for permanent placement. Many of the sections in Article 2 reorder and align existing legal steps required to achieve permanency in a more logical and legally sequential order. There are also many sections of Article 2 that contain provisions necessary for the state to achieve federal compliance with the implementing Fostering Connections Act, achieving compliance with Title IV-E, and meeting new Child Abuse Prevention Treatment Act requirements. Other sections of Article 2 pertain to relative search activities, administrative review of foster care, and provisions for meeting Multi-Ethnic Placement Act and Inter-Ethnic Placement Act requirements. Article 3 is largely contains technical and conforming language, as well as some new policy related to child protection. And I will try to briefly go through this section by section, if that's what the committee would like.
Briefly, yes.
Briefly. Section 1 is related to CAFTA compliance. It actually covers reasonable efforts to achieve permanency. What's different in this is actually that it adds the sexual abuse of a child and status of a parent as a predatory offender to the categories of cases where reunification efforts are not required. Section 2 sets out the scope of the act, adds changes for consistency and clarity in language. It restates and strengthens that this policy is about efforts to achieve permanency for children in foster care, for developing two plans, one for reunification with a parent and a backup plan if that should fail, finding relatives, including both maternal and paternal relatives for children, and returning children at home as soon as it is safe to do so. Section 3 adds a cross-reference to 260D. Basically, actually the next three sections, Section 3, 4, 5, and 6, are largely definitions. And the first one, like I said, makes a cross-reference to a definition of child in 260D. Section 4 is a definition of putative father. This helps support our practice regarding working with fathers. Section 5 adds a definition, clarity around responsible social services agency. And Section 6 adds a definition of sibling. It actually supports the agency's work with siblings and making placement decisions. It's a broad definition of sibling, including one or more individuals who have parents in common through blood, marriage, adoption, and including sibling as defined by tribal code or custom. Section 7 adds that the juvenile court has a jurisdiction over permanency matters, including for children over 18 in some circumstances. This is one of the sections that pertains to implementing Fostering Connections requirements. Section 8 adds procedures to establish paternity in CHIPS cases. Again, this supports the agency's work to engage with fathers early on in the case. It cross-references to the Minnesota Parentage Act. It covers commencing a parent-child relationship, access to data, genetic testing, and then it clarifies that an order in this matter it would be filed in family court and that any subsequent matters for child support would be continued in a family court. Section 9 adds adoption cross-references to Chapter 259, and it just actually clarifies adoption process. Section 10 adds a timing requirement for a county juvenile treatment screening team to conduct a screening within 15 days of a request, and to include parent and guardians or legal custodians as part of that team. Section 11 changes terminology consistency and clarifies adoption proceedings for kids under guardianship, and it clarifies that adoption proceedings are confidential. Section 12 clarifies that the county attorney has responsibility to represent the agency in adoption of children under state guardianship. Section 13, actually at a last minute, that is a section that will be deleted. There was an oversight as we were preparing our amendment for today. Section 14 pertains to achieving compliance with the Child Abuse Prevention Treatment Act, federal act. It pertains to emergency removal hearings. It adds, this, again, that sexual abuse of a child and apparent predatory offender status is a category of case where efforts to reunify are not required. It permits the court to require assessments necessary to support development of a plan for reunification as soon as the child enters foster care. Those could be assessments like chemical dependency, mental health, parenting, or medical exam. Section 15 clarifies requirements for filing a case plan, and it references back to those assessments that we just talked about in the prior section, that those assessments would be used in developing the case plan. Section 16 clarifies best interest requirements extend to all stages of a child protection proceeding. It also requires the court to review status of agency efforts to find relatives no later than 3 months after the placement of a child, and clarifies continuing responsibilities to place siblings together in foster care. Section 17, again, necessary for implementing Fostering Connections Act, clarifies when the court has jurisdictions for children over age 18. Section 18, necessary for Title IV-E compliance, covers required judicial findings. It also clarifies and strengthens findings on reasonable efforts to finalize a permanency plan, reasonable efforts for reunification, ensuring both parents are involved in the case planning, conducting diligent search for relatives, identifying a backup plan in case a child may not be reunified, and provisions for placing siblings together. Section 19 clarifies duties to review both the case plan and the child's placement at review hearings, and again, this is a Title IV-E requirement.
Let me see if the committee has any questions on any of the previous sections and or sections not yet discussed. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on page 9, line 9.32, it says the court may order genetic testing of any putative father or any man presumed to be the father of a child who's subject of a juvenile protection matter unless paternity's already been adjudicated. Is that something that can already be done? That seems a little broad.
The question is that something that can already be done? Who wants to answer that? Name and go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I'm Ann Alstrom. I'm with the Children's Justice Initiative, which is a joint project between the Department of Human Services and the Minnesota Supreme Court, and I'm here on behalf of the Department of Human Services. One of the issues faced by courts who have children in front of them who are in foster care is the identity of both parents, and the judges frequently struggle with who is the father of a particular child. The ideal way to address this is to quickly get names of people who do not have legal relationships with their children, and to get genetic testing done and to get paternity established. It is true that there's another process for this in family court. The idea here is to consolidate the proceedings so that paternity may be addressed in the context of the juvenile protection matter, the father may be established as the father, or ruled out. Sometimes that happens too. So the agency knows who to work with, the child has a father, and the proceeding can offer him services if that's necessary, or if he's appropriate and fit, to put the child with him so the child wouldn't even need to be in foster care.
Thank you.
I can understand the need. I can understand why it'd be really useful to be able to do this, but that's not really my question. I mean, under current law, can you already do this? I mean, I don't know what the meaning of the word putative is here. You know, how much cause do you have to bring somebody in and basically make them get genetic testing? That's kind of my concern. It's more on the end of how broad can you sweep here so that, you know, there's, I have two adult sons, you know. I don't want them to be suddenly dragged in for testing.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Olson.
Representative, there is definition of putative father added, which is the definition of putative father in the Adoption Act, and it is basically anybody who has been named as the father by the mother or who steps forward and registers with the father's adoption registry but does not otherwise have a legal relationship with the child. So somebody has to name him. Or he has to step forward and say, I am the father of this child.
Representative Liebling, anything further?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I don't want to belabor this, and I know you're trying to move quickly, but it's so all it takes is for the mother to name somebody? There's nothing more? I mean, is that it? Because I can, well, I don't know. And again, I'm not really sure if that's current law, and you're just putting it in this section, or is this something new?
Ms. Alstrom, is that a yes?
It is current law, and that is all it takes.
Any other questions or discussion?
Thank you.
Any discussion? Already determined there's no further testifiers in the audience. Therefore, Chair renews his motion that House File 1423, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair would like now to bring House File 1001, Representative Woodard, before the committee. The chair moves House File 1001 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Good morning. Do you have an amendment, I believe, A1?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair. We do have an A1 amendment that we'd like to move as well.
All right. The chair will move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author wants. Is there any discussion? Hearing none. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Bill's before us as amended. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1001 takes a look at organized retail crime, and I actually have a lot of background in this particular area as a director at the Target Corporation and dealing with organized retail crime. Saw the impact of this on not only businesses in Minnesota, but also on consumers. If you look at some of the things that have occurred in organized retail crime with baby formula thefts that have put baby formula that's been expired into the hands of mothers throughout the state and throughout the nation, this is an issue that we really need to address in Minnesota. Roughly 23 other states have passed similar legislation, and so I'm happy to put this before you as legislation for Minnesota. What the A1 amendment does is it delineates exactly what we want to do with felony theft in this particular case, and that's to put it in the racketeering category. When we heard this in public safety, one of the concerns was, does this affect the moms or dads who are involved in one or two or three thefts and really aren't involved in organized retail crime? So we really tightened the language to just put it into retail crime, and Mr. Brown here can testify to that effect on the legal implications of that, if that's okay with you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Brown, that'd be fine. Try to keep it brief, and then we'll see if we have questions. Anyone in the audience wanting to be heard on this bill, raise your hand now. Mr. Brown, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Woodard and members, thank you very much. This bill is the product of a great deal of work by the Association of Retailers, Grocers, Representative Woodard, sheriffs, county attorneys coming together to try and find a way to target these organized retail theft rings in a way that would make sure that we could get effective penalties for them when we caught them and not capture what we would think of as ordinary shoplifters, even if it's two or three people going into store together if they're not part of some organized ring. What we have done here is add general theft to the racketeering statute. It allows us to target organized crime rings because of the way racketeering is defined. It will not impact typical low-level shoplifters. The racketeering statutes are an unranked offense under the guidelines, which means the judge has discretion to figure out not only what kind of organized ring was this, but where did each participant fit within the crime ring, so can tailor the penalties to fit the crime. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would simply stand for questions.
Any questions from the committee of this witness? I don't see any. Any further discussion on House File 1001, Representative Liebling, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Woodard, to the testifier, I hear you saying this doesn't affect the regular old shoplifter or a couple people. I mean, you know, often, you know, it's pretty common that it would be a couple of people together. You know, one distracts the clerk and the other one walks out with the TV or something like that. As I'm reading this, it seems like, you have $1,000, value of $1,000 as the threshold for this, or is...
Representative Woodard.
Representative Liebling, what the A1 amendment, and I apologize for not being more clear on that, it eliminates Section 1 and 2. This was the original bill that we talked about in public safety, so I apologize for that, Representative Liebling, but that will no longer apply. That was the same issue that was brought up in public safety.
Representative Liebling.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Any further discussion on House File 1001? Chair renews his motion that House File 1001, as amended, be recommended to pass, be referred to Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you,
Representative. Mr. Chair, members.
Representative Wardlow, House File.
No.
Strike that. Representative Crawford. I'm jumping ahead again. Sorry. House File 705. Chair will move House File 705 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Get the bill in the shape that I think we want to discuss it. Chair sees we've got a couple of amendments, the A110380 amendment. Let's move on that. Hearing no discussion, those in favor of that amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. And the chair also moves the eighth.
The amendment. This is the eighth amendment.
What is that? I don't see it. A3 amendment. Hang on. Okay, the A3 amendment dealing with a law library fund. Hearing no discussion, all those in favor of the A3 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. That amendment is adopted. What about this?
We will wait on those.
Okay. All right, the bill is as currently amended is before us.
My apologies, that last amendment was not in the packet.
Okay. All right. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think there's another amendment that was written. It was quoted A11-0435.
We were going to wait until after testimony.
We'll do testimony and get to that. We'll do testimony first, then go on. Is there anyone in the audience who wants to be heard in testimony on this bill? Raise your hand, please. I want to count. Keep your hand up, please. All right, I see five hands. We're going to take 15 minutes on this bill, so everybody keep that in mind. Representative, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Also, I have an oral amendment. I would like to delete Section 4 of the bill. Basically, it's we were going to allow a change from shall to may, but we decided in the best interest of the inspectors that we should keep it as it is. So we would like to delete that.
So, Representative, that would be page 3, lines 3.11 to 3.22. Is that correct? Yes.
Yes, all right. Mr. Chair.
On that oral motion, any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 705 is basically a bill that is what we call a mandate relief. All of these sections in the bill have been requested by our counties or cities, sometimes school districts, local units of government, to provide them more flexibility in the age of allowing them to do more with less. So the first section of the bill, most of the bill is not too controversial. There are two parts of the bill that are fairly controversial. I'd like to go over Section 1. It's very similar or exact to a bill that was passed recently. It allows counties to do their own audits. And I do have a testifier for this, if you'd like to come down for the CPAs.
Give us your name and then take 2 minutes to tell us what to do or what not to do and then tell us why.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Gino Fragnino. I'm the Government Relations Director for the Minnesota CPA Society, and I will keep my comments brief. Section 1 would allow the county governments to engage a private CPA firm to conduct their audits. Some counties currently are allowed to engage a private CPA firm. Some are not. Some have wanted to, some have not wanted to. Our support is in the bill would allow is premised on allowing all the counties the opportunity. They wouldn't necessarily have to, but they could engage a private CPA firm if they would like to. For those counties who have engaged a private CPA firm, many times the costs for the overall audit has been reduced in the scope of what's done and with the costs of what has taken place with the state auditor versus the private firm. So this legislation was originally enacted about 8 years ago and was permissive at that time, and we would support allowing this to go a step further and allow all counties the opportunity to, if they choose, engage a private CPA firm.
Any questions of this testifier? Representative Champion.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, you indicated that there are counties that want to engage a private firm but cannot. Can you identify those counties that want to engage a private CPA but cannot?
Mr. Chair, Representative Champion, I do not have the list with me today. I can get some further information for you.
Representative Champion?
One follow-up, and this is to the author of the bill. Have you had a discussion with those counties, and have they provided you any documentation that seems to suggest that they want to engage a private CPA firm to do their audits but cannot?
Representative Crawford.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Champion, no, I haven't.
No further questions.
Okay. Are there any further questions? Representative Moline.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, and to the author, is there a fiscal note attached to this bill?
Representative Crawford.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moline, I believe there is in the what we have in the packet here. It mentions it, but it's very difficult to get an exact figure on it because we don't know, you know, how many counties would take advantage of it, because the more counties that take advantage of it, the less revenue into the state.
Representative Maylene.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author. I guess I'm concerned that apparently counties want this, but you're unable to identify any counties that have wanted this, and there's no discussion with counties. So could you maybe walk through the fiscal note with us a little bit?
Representative Crawford.
Yep. Mr. Chair, maybe I could call Mr. Carlson down. He might be able to answer this as to, which counties have requested this.
Representative Crawford.
Yes.
I'm not
yes,
aware Mr. of a Chair. Fiscal note on this bill. So why are we talking about a fiscal note?
Mr. Chair, you're correct. There is no fiscal note. I was handed something beforehand that was it was prepared earlier for the different bill that's the same.
Okay. Which is why we're sending it to Ways and Means as well. Discussion, questions? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it was a fiscal note that was prepared for a different bill that is the same. So basically the same language is in a different bill, and it costs money in that bill, and we don't know if it costs money in this one. Is that what I'm hearing?
Representative Crawford, House File 7. House File 7.
Yep, Ms. Chair.
Go ahead.
This is, yes, that's correct.
That's not before us. House File 705 is. Testimony. Additional testimony from someone else in the audience.
Okay.
Good morning, Mr.
Good
Chair.
Morning.
Good morning,
go ahead.
And members. I'm Rebecca Otto, the state auditor. Our office conducts audits of local governments and specifically counties. I don't know if you want to discuss the policy issues around this. There are some policy issues, but this is like one of the only finance committees that I can get in front of to say this bill has not had a fiscal note drafted specifically for it. I thought the state had a huge deficit. And this will cost the state in fiscal year 12 over $2 million in the first year. If all counties were to go private, we had to do kind of the worst case scenario. And right now our audit division doesn't really cost us the general fund anything because we get an appropriation that's for 70% of our office and then we put it back. So this actually starts having an impact on the general fund, which I think is probably difficult at this point for the state and committees because of their budget targets, well, coming budget targets. And so with that, I hope that we're happy to draft a fiscal note for this particular language so that you all can contain that within your spreadsheets. And Mr. Chair, I believe the bill also doesn't allow us to charge fees for reviews of audits. We normally review audits. The counties pay for that. So when they get audited by a private CPA firm for the number that do, we are required to review those to make sure that they are up to snuff. We have found one that was not and had to be reissued. So sometimes there are problems out there in the private sector, as we know. Arthur Anderson, I don't know, that's this one, you might remember them. Anyway, so we're there for the taxpayers and want to continue to do that. But if we can't charge the counties for that to review, if more go private, then the state pays for it. So that's another cost if many of them stayed, you know, some stay with us, some don't. It's going to cost the state money, so.
Thank you, Auditor Otto. I noticed that you've submitted a May 5, 2011 letter.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And it's been passed around. It's been given to the committee. Attached to it mm-hmm. is a fiscal note to a bill which is not before us here today. I don't know how helpful that is.
And Mr. Chair, the reason why it's provided is because there's a whole bunch of these things floating around with the same language. And so what we're doing is we just keep pumping out similar fiscal note for the similar bills. It's eating up a lot of staff time, but we keep doing it. And as this nonpartisan fiscal staff asks us for specific fiscal notes for this language, we produce it. So I wanted to make the committee aware, since you are a finance committee, that there is a cost to the state of over $2 million in 12, and then $500,000 thereafter for the next 3 years, which I think is difficult for the state to absorb. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. I'll just repeat that when a state agency wants to testify in this committee, they should limit their testimony to the bill before us. Thank you. Next testifier, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move to the repealer on collective bargaining, and I'd like to have Linda Run come down from the League of Minnesota Cities, and Keith Carlson from the counties. This is 471.6161 Subdivision 5.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Keith Carlson with the Minnesota Intercounty Association. I have had a memo distributed that describes the current state of the law with regards to basically employee health care benefits for local government employees in Minnesota. Under the current state of the law, basically the unions have a veto authority over any changes that reduce the aggregate value of those benefits, both during the term of the collective bargaining agreement and after those collective bargaining agreements have expired. Basically, they have veto authority in perpetuity until such time as they give notice of their desire to strike. Basically, the effect of that is to tie the hands of local governments in responding to cost increases that their insurers tell them they will be subject to if they do not make changes in the policy. Probably the most egregious example was the basis of litigation between the West St. Paul Federation of Teachers and the West St. Paul School Districts. The school district was facing an 11.3% increase in its premiums that they informed the union that they were facing for, and they discussed the subject in their insurance committee that was made up of representatives of both organized labor as well as management. Basically, at that time, they had two plans. Both through Medi-Cal. One was an open network plan where every individual could go to a provider of his or her choice, and then a limited network plan that, of course, had lower premiums. The benefits were the same under both policies. It was agreed in that insurance committee to reduce the premium increase to 5%. That they would increase the out-of-pocket maximums for the open network plan, but they would keep benefits exactly identical for the limited network plan. No changes in benefits whatsoever. It's just you would have to limit your choice of your medical providers. The courts ruled under this law that that was an illegal change. Again, no change in benefits. It's just that you would have to constrain your choice of providers to those that basically provided the cheaper option, still a 5% increase. Local governments have opposed this provision ever since. I do want to make clear the repeal of this provision, as I enumerate in this individual, this memo does not allow us to abrogate any contract provisions that exist currently. If the contract specifies the provider, if it specifies the co-pays, if it specifies the deductibles, we have to abide by that just like anybody else does who's the party to a contract. It also does not eliminate collective bargaining for these benefits. As I've laid out in the memo, and I've provided citations to each one of the statutes that govern collective bargaining includes fringe benefits, and it's an unfair labor practice for a public employer to not agree to meet and negotiate over those subjects. So all the repeal of this rule is doing is basically changing the balance that exists currently, where basically if the unions do not agree to a change in those policies, the employer is stuck with the increased premium increase. So we very much encourage you to keep the repealer in this bill.
Any questions of this witness? Anyone else, Representative Crawford?
That's it, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Run.
Oh. Yes, Mr. Chair, Ms. Run.
Besides the lady at the table, any other testifiers in the audience, raise your hand, please. All right, go ahead. Hi.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lisa Rund. I am an HR manager with the League of Minnesota Cities. I will be very brief. I concur with Mr. Carlson's statements and just wanted to reiterate a couple of things. First, as he said, this does not take away anybody's rights to negotiate on benefits. That's always been a mandatory subject of bargaining. Where I see issues in working with cities have been especially smaller cities, and I would say up to those cities even with 200 employees, it can be very difficult because any single bargaining group probably does not have enough employees where the insurance company will agree to have a separate plan. So you really need all employee groups to agree. And the way the law is currently, if any one employee, if any one union group does not agree to the changes, it prohibits the whole rest of the city from implementing changes. And typically, in a lot of cases that I've seen, that's where there's been wide support from other employee groups who have wanted to change. So just to reiterate, I would, the League of Minnesota Cities would support repealing this, the aggregate value of benefits. And I will take questions if there are any.
Any questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Any other testifiers?
Mr. Chair, I don't have any more.
All right. I see no other hands. Therefore, I'll close the public testimony. We'll move to consider a couple other amendments. And then and then go to discussion. Representative Johnson, would you like to offer your amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Yes. I'd like to move the A110435 amendment. And members, this amendment does two things. It's sought out by the Ramsey County Community Corrections. It does two things, as I said. It repeals a section of law that was created specifically for Ramsey County back in 1974. This section of law laid out certain duties of the department back in 74. Many of these duties aren't relevant anymore to the department and haven't been performed for decades, such as psychiatric and psychological and medical diagnosis or marriage counseling. Those duties aren't part of the job. Instead, Ramsey County Corrections will be directed to rely on Minnesota Statutes 401, which is the Community Corrections Act. So that's in sum what the bill does. It's a needed update for county corrections in Ramsey County, and it more accurately reflects what, in fact, we do. And it's supported by the county board and by the Minnesota Inter-County Association. So that in sum is the amendment, members.
Any discussion on the amendment? Representative Crawford, do you accept that amendment?
Mr. Chair, yes, I do.
All right, on the amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Final amendment here. The chair moves the A2 amendment. And that's brief, but you'll notice on page 4, line 20, there's a repealer of statute 471.6161. I've talked with the Subdivision 5, repealing that. I've spoken with the author of the bill, Representative Crawford. I believe you accept the amendment to leave that language as is. I mean, to amend it accordingly.
Mr. Chair, yes, I do.
Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. House file 705 as amended now is before us. Any discussion? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be encouraging members to vote no. This basically privatizes the state auditor's office. It does, in fact, have a cost to the state general fund based on the language of the bill, and I encourage members to vote no.
Further discussion? Representative Hillstrom.
Oh, roll call, please, Mr. Chair.
Roll call has been requested, and hearing no further discussion, clerk, take the roll.
Chairman Smith?
Yes.
Vice Chair Schmansky?
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Anderson?
Yes.
Representative Champion?
No.
Representative Cornish?
Yes.
Representative Greenhagen?
Yes.
Representative Hillstrom?
No.
Representative Creaso. Representative Lane. Representative Lesh.
No.
Representative Liebling.
No.
Representative Nasrallah.
Yes.
Representative Malin.
No.
Representative Schumacher.
Yes.
Representative Bogle.
Yes.
Representative Wardlow.
Yes.
There being 9 ayes and 6 nays, motion prevails. Bill is passed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
All right, House File 211, Representative Wardlow. Bringing this bill back before the committee, Representative Wardlow moves House File 211 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Author, you, Representative Wardlow, I believe you have a delete all amendment. Representative Wardlow would move A11-0440 amendment.
Yes.
Get the bill in the shape that you want it.
One second, Mr. Chair. Before we do that, I'd like to make an oral amendment to the delete all amendment, the A11 amendment.
Go ahead. Tell us what it is.
On page 6, line 6. Delete the word occurred and insert in its place the word accrued.
Chair, I'll accept that as an incorporated author's oral amendment to the amendment. Okay.
And then, in addition, along the same lines, on page, not the same line, but on page 6, line 11, after the word action, insert arising from incidents. And strike or arising.
Strike what?
Or arising. Or occurring. Sorry.
Accruing. Or accruing?
Accruing, sorry.
Third time's a charm.
Or accruing, right. So it will read, applies to causes of action arising from incidents on or after that date.
Mr. Diebel, do you have that down? And Rebecca? Curious? All right. Motion is before us to get the bill in the shape the author wants. So all those in. You're right. Excuse me. Representative Wardlow, well, Chair will consider that additional oral motion incorporated in the amendment. Representative Wardlow renews his motion on the amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Go ahead.
Okay, thank
bill
you.
Is before us as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 211 is now the Omnibus Torts Bill. It's a compilation of a number of bills, all of which we have heard before. I will concentrate my comments on a few changes we've made to the original House File 211 and 654, the Statute of Limitations Bill. But before I do that, I'd ask House Research to just go through the sections of the bill and remind members what exactly the bills were and the authors and the subject.
Ms. Pierce, go ahead, please.
Mr. Chair and members, I'll be working off the summary. Sections 1, 4, and 5 are from House File 32. These sections enact new tort liability limits for claims against states or municipalities if the claim involves a nonprofit engaged in outdoor recreational activities. Sections 2 and 3 are from House File 1343. These sections establish civil immunity for school districts that make their facilities available for recreational use by members of the public. And 4 and 5 we just discussed. Section 6 is from House File 868. It's increasing the monetary threshold for filing civil actions in conciliation court. And these numbers were actually changed. It will now be raising the general monetary threshold from $7,500 to $10,000, and for consumer credit actions, $4,000 to $5,000. Section 7 is from House File 211, the first engrossment. It's only one section, the last section of that bill. It permits a court's order related to certification of a class in a class action suit to be appealed. Section 8 is from House File 654, as amended. It's reducing certain statutes of limitations from 6 to 4 years. Section 9 is from House File 770, the first engrossment. It's making changes to how interest rates are computed for judgments. Section 10 is from House File 747. Is providing that when awarding attorney's fees, the court must take into consideration the reasonableness of the fees, and then also provides a limit on attorney fees awards in certain cases in which an offer for judgment is made but rejected. And finally, Section 11 is from House File 1217. It is creating a civil cause of action for sex trafficking victims.
Representative Wardlaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I would just direct your attention to page 4, section 7. That is the original, what's left of the original House File 211. We, in consultation with representatives of interested parties, struck the first part of the first two sections of the original House File 211, removing the changes to which would have added detrimental reliance and out-of-pocket loss damages requirements to actions under the Consumer Fraud, False Advertising, and Deceptive Trade Practices Acts, leaving only the interlocutory appeal and automatic stay of discovery provision. And then Section 8 we altered is House File 654, which we heard yesterday, I believe. And we made a number of changes in consultation with stakeholders. First of all, if you look at line 30 on page 5, we are now putting the contract statute of limitations, putting it back to 6 years, so that will remain at 6 years for statute of limitations on contracts. Secondly, for actions in actually response to concerns raised by Representative Moline and others, we are keeping the conduct constituting domestic abuse statute of limitations at 6 years. Page 6, we've added a discovery requirement, discovery rule, so that the statute of limitations does not commence to run until a reasonable person in the plaintiff's position either knows or should have known that the fact of the injury and the fact that the injury caused damages to the plaintiff. In addition, we're adding an outside limit, so from the time the statute of limitation would have began to run, or from the time a cause of action accrued, that is, when the cause of action facts are established such that the cause of action could pass the motion to dismiss, from that time out 6 years, regardless of the discovery rule, the 6 year statute of limitation has that outside bracket. And that summarizes the changes. So,
Representative Wardlaw, would you please repeat the last portion of your testimony?
Repeat the last portion?
About this discovery rule?
Oh, the discovery rule, okay. Now the 4 year statute of limitation, except for fraud and contracts, because fraud has a separate discovery rule and case law related to that, and contracts doesn't really apply. So it begins to run from the time a reasonable person in the plaintiff's position should have known that the injury occurred and that the injury caused damages to the plaintiff. But there's a 6 year outside limit from the time the cause of action accrued. So in no instance will you be able to bring an action. And this is basically the current law after 6 years from the time the cause of action accrued.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom, would you please pull your microphone toward you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this will impact environmental law. And we currently have had cases in Minnesota law. Correct me if I'm wrong. This will impact environmental law, and we currently have had cases in environmental law where it was one standard, for example, when the property was purchased, and then we find out later on that the environmental standard is lower, and there's lead on the property or some contamination that causes defects or disabilities. And So this would say it doesn't matter if you didn't find that out for 25 years. You knew that that was on the property when you bought it, so 6 years from now, you can't ever sue for that.
If you knew that it was on the property, if you should have known that, no, actually, the cause of action accrues when facts establishing the entire cause of action, including all elements of the cause of action, exist and are known. So that includes damages.
Mr.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I buy the property when I know there's something on it, I just don't know, say, asbestosis. We're going to talk about that later today. I buy property, and I know there's asbestosis on the property, but I don't know how bad asbestosis is until 25 years. Asbestos, sorry. I don't know how bad it is for 25 years. When does the cause of action that I can bring stop? Is it 25 years later?
It would
later?
Begin to run.
Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It would begin to run, Representative Hillstrom, at the time at which a person in your position reasonably should have known, right? And then extend out for 4 years in no event later than 6 years from the time the cause of action accrues. The time the cause of action accrues is dependent on when you know that the damages would occur. So maybe House Counsel can provide some clarification.
Ms. Debo, no comment on that?
No.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Does anyone else have an opinion to render here? Please come forward and introduce yourself for the table.
Mr. Chairman, members, just so we're clear, on the issue of the statute of limitations or just on the bill in general? Which
statute of limitations.
Just on that issue? Mr. Chairman and members, Joel Carlson for the Association for Justice. I think we need to...
Mr. Carlson, excuse me. Somebody's got an alarm going off. Could you see that, please? I see it.
I
better hearing than
amendment.
I do.
What did he say?
Okay, sorry to interrupt. Go ahead, Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman and members, I think we need to dig a little deeper on the environmental response and liability. There's a federal law, CERCLA, that governs your environmental liability and response. I don't believe that it is directly impacted by the language in the DE amendment, but I'm happy to get back to you on that. Federal law requires the reach back when there is contamination to soil and property, and if you're in the chain of title, you assume that liability, and it would be our opinion that this doesn't impact that.
I would concur.
Further discussion. Do we have any further testimony? Gentlemen?
Yes, sir. Come to the table.
Mr. Chairman,
Joe, I apologize.
That's all right.
Go right ahead.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman and members, when Representative Westrum announced yesterday it was his last civil law committee for the session, I went to church and lit a candle. this has been a long session, and I think I'm getting close to making my last appearance here for the year. And I want you to know, Mr. Chairman and members, that me personally and our association appreciates all of the time and attention that you've given to our association on these very important issues for consumers. And each of you have met with us and you've heard our concerns. Well, we haven't won all of our fights. I want you to know I appreciate it. And even Representative Grunhagen, when we had the asbestos bill and you told me and my client that you don't like trial lawyers, and I felt a little demonized that day, I just want you to know that you've been very gracious and open in talking to us about these issues, and we do appreciate it.
Mr. Carlson, Abraham Lincoln was a trial lawyer as well.
And I'm going to actually, you stole my note, man. That's my last comment here. We've been talking too much. On the way over today, I heard on the radio from Allstate Insurance Company that mayhem is everywhere. Mayhem is everywhere. And they tell us that on TV. They tell us that on the radio. And whether it's the tree falling on your house, the distracted teenage driver, the hot blonde in the pink, OMG, mayhem is everywhere, and they tell us that repeatedly. And what I would like to tell you is that when mayhem strikes you or your family or your business, the delete everything amendment just makes your life a little bit worse. And you need to know, and I want to acknowledge, that there are significant improvements in this bill, and I want to just briefly touch on them. But on balance, this bill benefits insurance companies. It really doesn't advance the ball for consumers or individuals. And while it is a significant improvement from a number of the proposals that we've dealt with, and I want to acknowledge those and recognize them, we've got quite a ways to go. Mr. Chairman and members, the Section 1 of the bill is an insurance provision. It's not a tort provision. Insurance companies weren't selling $1.5 million policy for nonprofits that want to do good things for our community, and so we've acknowledged that dropping the insurance level down to $1 million is a way to promote those activities, and we don't oppose that provision of the bill. Likewise with Section 3 of the bill, relative to the recreational use of school property, you know, we don't believe that there is a problem there, but the language that is in the bill we think can help serve to clarify what the law is. We think it's close or is identical to what the status of the law is, and so we don't oppose it, but it is not a a tort issue so much as a concern about exposure and liability, and we don't oppose that section of the bill. The next section that I'd like to comment on the bill, Mr. Chairman, is on page 4, on section 7 of the bill. And while we acknowledge that the eliminating consumer fraud, unfair trade practice, and deceptive advertising provisions from House File 211 is a significant improvement, and we thank Representative Wardlow for deleting that provision from the bill, it's still alive in the Senate. I don't know if they've abandoned that for the session or not, but we appreciate it not being in here. You need to know that while the taking of an interlocutory appeal does not give us particular heartburn, we do have concerns, significant concerns, about the legislature stepping in and controlling the discovery process in litigation. And, you know, and we would ask that while you may want to, as a matter of right, grant a defendant who is accused of fraud or deceptive practice the right to an interlocutory appeal, we think that that lines 4.35 through 5.3 is really an intrusion into the judicial process of controlling discovery, and we think that should be deleted from the bill, and we've been consistent. And we'd also note that while there's an exception to allow a party to make a motion, that does not reduce litigation. That promotes litigation. I'm going to have to go to court. If this idea is to reduce litigation in the courts, this promotes it. It doesn't reduce it. Section 8 of the bill, Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to acknowledge Representative Wardlow's hard work on this section. This is a significant improvement from the original bill. It does provide for a discovery rule. It does protect victims of domestic abuse and their right to bring a cause of action. It retains our right to bring a contract claim at 6 years. Of all of the improvements in the bill, this is, I think, the most dramatic, and we appreciate Representative Wardlow's hard effort on that provision of the bill. Having said that, you know, we didn't really see any reason on frivolous cases or non-meritorious cases being brought forward, but that is a significant improvement from where we started with a flat four-year statute of limitations. Likewise, on Section 9, on the insurance, what insurance companies pay on a judgment that is owed to a consumer, Section 9 is a substantial improvement from bringing us back to being the lowest in the country. And we appreciate that, but you need to know that while a consumer who's owed money from someone's negligent conduct, and we're paying 18 or 20% on our credit cards, we are now reducing the amount of interest that we would receive back for that period of time while we've had to fund our own efforts, and we're reducing what insurance companies pay, and while it's drastically better, it still is a step backwards. Mr. Chair and members, we have testified and we have substantial problems with Section 10 of the bill. Subdivision 1 of the bill puts a spotlight on proportionality on what is awarded to a successful defendant in a sexual harassment case or any of the 300 different statutory fee shift provisions we have in law. And you need to know that the Supreme Court and our Minnesota Supreme Court have specifically rejected this proportionality provision that is in Subdivision 1 of the bill. It is unfair to parties who prevail in court, and we have strongly opposed that for about 11 years now. We also have concerns about Subdivision 2 of the bill on offers of judgment. That is a court rule governed by court rule and procedure. The provision of this bill was last addressed by the Minnesota Supreme Court in 2008, and the provision of this bill was specifically rejected by the court as being unfair to litigants who need to have the ability to pursue their claims, and we have significant problems with that, and we continue to oppose that provision. Section 11 is the chairman's bill relative to providing a civil cause of action for victims of human sex trafficking, and while we certainly support that on balance, it is not enough of a balance to the bill that would lend us to support the measure on its entirety. And Mr. Chairman and members, as you mentioned, the father of the Republican Party, Abraham Lincoln, was a circuit trial lawyer who actually successfully prosecuted the first premise liability or slip and fall case in our country. These provisions in this bill, we think, move us further away from our constitutional rights to redress and remedy, to full compensation, to separation of powers, and we have substantial concerns with the bill as it is in the form that it is in. I had a page pass around an article that I mentioned to you yesterday about risk facing businesses, and the suggestion that the statute of limitations is the number one thing that businesses look at when they're looking at locating a new facility or expanding is I think absolutely unfounded. It's certainly untrue. It's not consistent with any business that I've represented in the 21 years I've been in business. And we think that issues that are on this list of what the risks of business are more accurately reflect problems facing Minnesota businesses and job creation, and not the subject of what is now going to be House File 211. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, and we do appreciate all the time you've given us this session.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? I believe we had one more testifier. Two more, excuse me. Give us your name and then go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Grundhofer. Here representing the League of Minnesota Cities, the Minnesota School Boards Association, and also offering comments on behalf of Minnesota Intergovernmental County Association as well. We are generally supportive of almost all of the bill except Section 9 of the bill, and I direct your attention to line 7.17, I guess, of the amendment. I hope I have the reference right. It's the interest rate adjustment bill. The interest to be paid on pre-judgment and post-judgment interest. Over the last several years, that amount or that interest rate has fluctuated up and down for local governments. Last year we were successful in getting the interest rate to be tied to the Treasury bill rate. As a result of this amendment, as it's currently written, it's now the Treasury bill rate plus 8% for all local governments on pre-judgment and post-judgment interest. That only affects local government costs as well as the state. It has a significant cost implications for local governments. And frankly, I don't understand why it's necessary. Local governments have the obligation to pay their debts when they are imposed. And all this really does is impose significant additional costs to local governments and frankly the state as well. So we would express concerns about that particular section of the bill. Thank
you. Very good, thank you. Any questions? If not, next testifier, I believe that would conclude this testimony. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ron Eller with Legal Aid. First of all, I want to thank Representative Wardlow, Representative Mazerall, and Representative Szymanski for working with us on the three bills that they carry that we had concerns about. On Representative Wardlow's bill, really appreciate the changes you've made. I do concur with Mr. Carlson, however, on the continuing problem with the stay of discovery. On Representative Mazzarol's bill, again, agree with Mr. Carlson regarding the concerns about singling out the proportionality problem. I'd like to continue to work on improving this language, and I don't think we simply can, if we use that factor as the only one, that's what the courts will, if we single that out in the bill, that's what the courts will focus on. I think we'd need to work through that. I appreciate your willingness to continue to talk to me and Mr. Carlson and Representative Szymanski. Thank you so much. Appreciate the balance that you've struck on the conciliation court limits to assure that there's fairness in that venue. So appreciate all your work, members, and thank you for allowing me to testify.
Very good. Thank you. No further testimony, so we'll close that part of this hearing on this bill and then return it to the table for discussion. Any discussion? Representative Wardlow renewed his motion that House File 211 is a... Excuse me.
Sorry.
Hilstrom, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a roll call, Mr. Chair.
That'd be fine. Roll call's been requested on Representative Wardlow's renewed motion that House File 211 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means in the House. Clerk, take the roll.
Chairman Smith?
Yes.
Szymanski?
Yes.
Johnson?
No.
Anderson?
Yes.
Champion?
No.
Cornish?
Yes.
Grunhagen?
Yes.
Hilstrom?
No.
Creasel? Lane? Lesh?
No.
Liebling?
No.
Mazzarol?
Yes. Yes.
Moline?
You're voting twice, or?
No.
Schumacher?
Yes.
Vogel?
Yes.
Wardlow?
Yes.
There being nine ayes and six nays, the bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, member.
Ways and Means. Thank you. All right, we're going to shortly take a recess, but right now I want to move to another bill on the calendar, House File 1343 as amended. I'll bring it back to the committee with the motion that House File 1343 as amended be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. Any discussion of that motion? Hearing none, Chair renews that motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The bill is amended. 1343 is recommended to pass and is re-referred to the general register. All right, what we're going to do is this. We're going to recess at 10, but I think in the next few minutes, Representative Barrett, if you're here, come forward on House File 358. I know there. Before you have a seat, welcome to the committee. What I'd like to do is gauge how much time we have, so therefore I'd like to see a show of hands. All those in the room who want to be heard in testimony on this bill, either for or against, raise your hand now and keep it there. See about 10 to 12. Representative Baird, I'd like you to present the bill, and you have a testifier or a presenter with you?
I can bring up a testifier, yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Chair moves that House File 358 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. Just as a reminder, we'll let you present and the initial testifier, and then we'll take an approximate 20-minute break, and we'll come back to this room and take testimony on both sides. We'll probably take about an hour for testimony, and we'll just see how that works. Representative Barrett, go ahead. Bill is before us.
Sure. Ask then that Captain Darrell Huggett come forward.
Morning. Have a seat, give us your name, and then Representative Barrett, go forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This is House File 358. The bill, as it sits before you, supports the federal laws related to illegal immigration, specifically the 1996 Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act, which mandates that local officials not restrict the sharing of information about illegal immigration with federal authorities. It also refers to Title 8, Section 1373, and Title 8, Section 1644. This bill is not anti-immigrant. Quite the contrary, the bill supports immigration that happens through the current legal process that our country has had in place for hundreds of years to support immigration into the United States. Certainly one thing we can take away from the tragic events of September 11, 2001 is that communication between the different branches of government is critically important to the security of our citizens, and lack of communication between jurisdictions results in tragedy. Many counties in our state are spending millions of dollars. Many counties in our state are spending millions of dollars to improve communication by purchasing 800 megahertz radio devices to be used for better communication in emergencies. Communication is critical. It's critically important, as we have seen. The bill, as it sits before you, allows for better communication between the various agencies related to a very important issue in our state. The current situation in our country regarding illegal immigration is confusing enough without having separate policies that collectively further confuse the issue. As other states such as Georgia, Florida, and Arizona enact laws and support the rights of their citizens and support federal laws, a worry is that the sanctuary that is communicated by local policies will attract more people to our state, which places a tremendous burden on our state. Studies suggest that the total cost of illegal immigration in our country is over $100 billion a year. Because of the clandestine nature of the issue, no one knows for sure what the real number is. There are costs related to education, human services, criminal justice, and these costs are real. As we all know, we have a $5 billion budget deficit, and we are having trouble meeting the needs of the people who are here legally. Department of Justice data says that 17% of those people incarcerated in federal prisons are Mexican citizens. About 50% of the offenses committed are drug-related. Meth is imported into the United States over the borders, mostly our southern border, as are other drugs. You have some information in front of you regarding drug movement into and within the United States that gives some more detail on this issue. There are drug tunnels being built along our southern border weekly or monthly. The cost of drug use and abuse in our country is over $1 billion a year. We have many good prevention and treatment programs in our country. One thing we have not done is prevent illegal drugs from coming in to our country. Drug use and abuse in our country is out of control and is affecting people of all races, ages, and genders. Not doing everything possible to support our federal laws related to illegal immigration has a profound effect on this issue. I have with me Daryl Huguet from the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office to further my testimony.
Deputy, give us your name and proceed, please.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Captain Daryl Huguet of the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office. Under Sheriff Richard Stanek, I oversee the Hennepin County Jail. You and your fellow legislators must decide on a policy proposed by House File 358 whether to prohibit so-called sanctuary policies in the state of Minnesota. I'm here to tell you how the Hennepin County Jail deals with the bookings of thousands of foreign-born individuals every year. The Hennepin County Sheriff's Office operates the Adult Detention Center, otherwise known as the jail. We're located downtown Minneapolis, just a couple blocks west of the Metrodome. All municipalities located in Hennepin County book arrestees into the Hennepin County Jail. We book approximately 40,000 persons each year. It should be noted that there are 17 cities in the county that also have their own local lockup, where they generally book and release lower-level offenders and not bring them downtown. These 17 municipalities combined book an additional 8,800 in 2010. The city of Minneapolis does not have their own lockup, and they bring all the arrestees to our jail. When the booking process begins for these 40,000 persons booked every year in our jail, each and every inmate is asked where they are born. Of the 40,000 bookings, about 4,500 claim to be foreign-born, and this is self-reported. In 2010, of these 4,500 people who brought into our jail by over 30 different law enforcement agencies, so regardless of whether they arrested in Minneapolis, Bloomington, or Minnetonka police departments, when they are booked into the Hennepin County Jail as part of our standard operating procedures, including mugshots and fingerprints, all inmates are asked their place of birth. There are different organizations that need this information for different reasons that are not related to immigration. For example, the jail is required to notify certain consulates if one of their citizens have been booked into the jail, and there are 58 consulates that require notification. If someone from an African nation of Nigeria is arrested and booked in our jail, then the Nigerian consulate wants to be notified. The person who is arrested might get a visit from the consulate. What? The same is true for Costa Rica, China, Poland, and a long list of other countries. The vast majority of these 4,500 people who claim to be foreign-born were arrested for crimes not related to immigration. They are being booked into the Hennepin County Jail and awaiting trial or sentencing or a release on bail. If an inmate needs an interpreter, we provide interpretive phone services that cover all languages that we encounter. For example, if an inmate is a Hmong person, we have access to interpreters that can speak all different dialects of Cambodia, Laos, and any other countries where they may have lived. For those inmates who state they are foreign-born, and that's self-reported, we then advise them that we are connecting them with an interview with an agent from the Federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, otherwise known as ICE. If they agree, then we will call ICE and set up the interview. If they refuse to be interviewed, then they are placed into detention like any other person. We then contact ICE, and they may fax over a detainer, which is a document authorizing us to detain that person until the inmate's status is determined. As one of the largest detention facilities in the Upper Midwest, ICE agents visit our jail every weekday. They review the booking sheets, they interview inmates, and they transfer foreign nationals to federal detention in other counties. Hennepin County does not have that contract. The ICE agents provide their own interpreters for these interviews. Of the 4,500, we receive about 85 inmates a year who are not wanted for other crimes, but they're either brought here under INS hold-only orders or taken into custody because they've completed their court cases. The prosecutor may have dropped the charges, or the person may have been acquitted. Of these 85 inmates on INS hold-only orders, they are only with us 1.6 days on average because they are taken to other jails that with contracts to hold federal inmates pending the resolution on their deportation cases. Strong partnerships across local, state, federal law enforcement are important and encouraged. This was part of the 9/11 Commission recommendation. We do not want silos of information. If someone is arrested for committing crimes in Hennepin County and booked in our jail, they will be checked out by the federal agencies. We partner with ICE just like we partner with the FBI, the Secret Service, or Homeland Security on public safety issues. We are a nation of immigrants. For immigrant communities, the criminal justice system can seem very confusing and intimidating. That is why I'm working to reach out to so many of the new Minnesotans. We have created a community service unit that meets regularly with leaders from various groups of immigrant population. We give them jail tours and explain our process. We listen to their concerns and guidance on how to provide due process and basic dignity for inmates and their relatives and friends who visit them. We hold mini academies for ethnic groups to explain how Sheriff's Office works with an eye toward recruiting our first-generation deputy of Hmong, Somali, Latinos, and others who are adding strength to our county. You'll have to decide on the policy represented by this bill. but I want you to be aware of how we process the 4,500 foreign-born inmates in our jail who are arrested for crimes each year and how we partner with our federal agencies.
Captain Huguet, thanks. We're going to try to get a few questions in yet before 10. Can you come back after our recess?
Absolutely.
Very good, Chairman. Let's do a question or two now. Representative Lesh, then Hillstrom, then Johnson. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Captain Huguet, you stated that there's like 4,500 inmates that come through, 85 on INS hold only. Do you anticipate that that number would go up or go down if this legislation were to pass?
Captain Huguet.
Representative, I really would be able to determine whether it would go up and down. That we're a facility that accepts inmates, and it's dependent on the arresting agencies.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Captain Huguet, let me do another step then. Would you anticipate that in Minneapolis or Hennepin County, local law enforcement agencies would increase arrests and detentions for individuals under this bill, or would they decrease arrests and detentions under this bill?
Captain Huguet.
Again, I don't think I would be able to answer that.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a little confused because I hear the numbers, the burdensome numbers that you have to deal with, that you're forced to handle under the current funding structure, and I'm trying to figure out if we're adding tasks to local law enforcement. And what I'm hearing from my police officers in St. Paul is that they can only respond to calls now. They can't do any proactive policing. Community policing is kind of a joke because all they do is respond to calls, and they either advise or they have to write a report, which takes even more time. So I'm trying to figure out if this is going to add tasks to their daily job or if it's going to decrease the tasks. And what I'm hearing from you is that you don't know, but the bill that's in front of us, as I understand it, would add tasks. Perhaps, Mr. Chair, the chief author would care to comment on that.
Representative Barrett.
Chair Smith, Representative Lesh, I'd be happy to comment on that. I guess I wouldn't know the exact number either because I don't know exactly how many illegal immigrants we have in our cities currently. But one of the things I would look forward to is having a city or cities in our state that don't have that tag of sanctuary city that might actually allow for or cause fewer people who are illegal to come to our cities. That might be a way, might not be. So I don't know that anyone could answer your question directly because we just don't have a lot of detailed information on how many and what crimes they commit or don't commit. A lot of that information it would be nice to have so we could really put a box around this issue, but unfortunately that box is not there.
Okay,
we know the issues, we know the problems, we know the costs, but we don't know. We can't quantify them.
Representative Lesh.
And I just have two brief questions for the author, Mr. Chair. First of all, are there more undocumented workers in our cities now that should be picked up or detained based on their immigration status that aren't being picked up?
Representative Barrett.
Chair Smith, Representative Lesh, I'm not quite sure I understand your question.
Okay, let me rephrase it, please.
Representative Lesh.
Are there people out there, undocumented people living in our cities, who should be picked up by INS right now?
Representative Barrett.
I can't state emphatically, but I would say yes.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair, then my second question is, do you anticipate under this bill that those people would be dealt with by immigration? It would help immigration deal with them.
Representative Barrett.
I think what this bill does is it eliminates any barriers to a police officer or agency doing their jobs as they see fit to do it. It doesn't ask for them to do anything in particular, but it allows for that to happen. And certainly right now, they, because of policies, they couldn't do their job effectively based on policies that are created in certain cities.
Well, just by way of comment, Mr. Chair, I want to ask some more questions because I know we're limited on time, but you use the phrasing, see fit to do it. Those departments, in their wisdom, have seen fit to ensure that they're not overburdened by policies that aren't best protecting the public with the limited resources and funds that they have. So I'm just wondering who sees fit, because right now you're deciding that the overarching arm of state government sees fit better than the locals. That's all I have.
At this point, on the one hand, I want to apologize for taking your break, but we're going to take a brief recess. And on the other hand, this is an important issue, and there are testifiers on both sides that deserve time in this committee to be heard. So we're simply going to take an approximate 20-minute recess and give as full and fair time to testifiers after that. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just the question is, are you going to bring this testifier up for me to ask questions of this testifier right after the break, or are you moving on to other testifiers, Mr. Chair?
I will accommodate any request within reason.
Mr. Chair, I would like to ask questions of this testifier.
That's fine.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Maylene.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. I have Jobs Committee at 10:15, and I did have a quick question for this testifier then, if I could ask that now.
Please do, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, a quick question. You kept saying 4,500 foreign-born. Are they here illegally, or are they just foreign-born?
Captain Huguet.
We identify them as foreign-born. They self-report. So whether they're here illegally or not, that's...
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, my only comment is there's a lot of foreign-born people here legally.
Yes, correct.
All right, 20-minute committee's in recess. We're going to resume with testimony, and we're going to schedule this bill for discussion at 1 hour from now, and then I'd like to take a vote. We're going to take a vote on it by 11:45. So 1 hour for testimony. When members, when you're asking questions, please try to keep it two questions. I will have enough time at the end for discussion and presenting of our opinions before we vote. Representative Barrett, I think we're going to shift gears with testifiers because we have two law enforcement officers here. Since they're cops or whatever they are, they're going to. I'm going to defer to them. So let's take the officer from Minneapolis, I think, next. And I know you have to leave, so take 5 or 10, and we may have a question or two. Please proceed. Give us your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Robert Allen. I'm a Deputy Chief of Police in Minneapolis, and I really appreciate the opportunity to be heard on House File 358. I have four main points of concern with this bill. The first one is that the bill is unnecessary. Minneapolis takes crime fighting very seriously. In 2010, Minneapolis hit a 27-year low in Part 1 crimes. Year-to-date in 2011, we're down more than 15% in Part 1 crimes from last year. If you commit a crime in our city, we will work very hard to make sure you are held accountable for that crime. And we don't work alone. We partner with numerous other local agencies, county agencies, state agencies, and federal agencies, including the FBI, the U.S. Attorney's Office, ATF, and ICE. I am confident that if ICE listed the agencies with which they had partnered on investigations in Minnesota, the Minneapolis Police Department would be near the top of the list. As you heard from my friend Captain Huggett from Hennepin County, the system works. If you get taken into custody for a crime in the city of Minneapolis and you are in the United States illegally, ICE will be notified. Be assured, Mr. Chair and committee members, the City of Minneapolis does not want criminals in our city and will aggressively seek prosecution against criminals for all the crimes they commit, whether they're United States citizens or not. My second point is that this legislature has emphasized the value of local control of government, as local government knows what's best for its community. This bill removes that local control. It limits the ability of a police chief to direct the resources of the department. If the police chief decides that we need a policy of greater enforcement against motorists who don't yield to pedestrians, and an officer decides that he or she prefers to spend her time enforcing federal immigration law, this bill prohibits the chief from limiting those activities. This bill also prohibits the city from limiting the investigative activities of any of its workers. If a building inspector has a hunch that some tenants of a housing complex he or she is inspecting, that inspector is allowed to start running immigration checks on those tenants rather than focusing on the job of doing building inspections. If a receptionist is curious about the immigration status of someone visiting a city office, the city can't prevent that receptionist from contacting ICE or even starting a database immigration status on the immigration status of visitors to that city office. It turns out that conducting investigations is very difficult, and the rules for maintaining investigative databases are incredibly complex. So it would be very easy for someone who is not thoroughly trained in doing investigations or maintaining databases to violate privacy laws or commit some other civil infraction. If that were to happen, the city would be liable for the action of its employees. Yet this bill would not allow the city to limit the activities of the employees to avoid incurring that liability. This is not an unfunded mandate. It is an unfunded lawsuit against the city in waiting. I would mention that the liability that the city is likely to incur would also apply to the state of Minnesota for the activities of its public workers as well. And that brings me to my third point, that this bill is not fiscally conservative, but rather it will be very expensive for local governments. This bill creates two new classes of plaintiffs. A citizen who would rather have the police chief check the immigration status of day laborers than, say, enforce DWI laws could bring a writ of mandamus. More important to me, though, is that this bill also puts police officers in the potentially horrible position of being accused and sued for racial profiling. What is the basis for investigating a person's immigration status? Is it their race? Is it their speech? Or as one Arizona legislator suggested, their choice of clothing or footwear? My final point is that this bill makes Minnesotans less safe. The currency that police have in solving crime is the trust of the community we serve. When a crime occurs in the city, the police often cannot solve it unless people in the community are willing to talk to us. The fact that we were able to solve a triple homicide in the city of Minneapolis last year was largely because we had done a great deal of work developing trust in the Somali community, and many Somali citizens came to us with information that was critical to solving that horrible case. The fact that we solved a drive-by shooting that left a teenage girl paralyzed last year was because we had developed trust in the Latino community, and our Latino citizens were willing to come forward and talk to us. I urge you not to pass this bill and continue to allow our police officers to do what we do best, which is police our community. Thank you.
Deputy Chief Fallon, thank you. He has to leave shortly, so let's ask questions and try to keep it brief. Representative Hillstrom, Johnson, Cornish, and then Lesh. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if one of the employees who's not with the police department decides that they want to investigate the immigration status of someone and they find someone who's here illegally and they call the police, they call you, what will you have to do if this other employee finds someone?
Chief Allen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, it would be the responsibility of the police officer to pull that police officer from some other duty, which they may be performing, and go and pick up that person, presumably, and take them to jail.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I heard from the previous testifier that they ask if someone is foreign-born. Phil Carruthers was the Speaker of the House in the Minnesota House of Representatives, and he was born in Canada. So we know that he was foreign-born. So if someone here investigated former Speaker of the House, Phil Carruthers, and found out that, in fact, he was foreign-born, and he called law enforcement, what would they have to do to confirm whether or not he really was here legally or not?
Chief Allen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I don't have a lot of experience in it, but my experience that we have in investigations, when we have somebody who is foreign-born and we're not sure of the immigration status and are curious about it, we work with ICE, and it takes them a fairly significant amount of time to determine the person's immigration status. It's not something that you can run somebody on a computer and determine whether they're here legally or not. It actually requires a search that may take a fair amount of time. There's an 800 number that we call.
Mr.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill would allow me, as a government employee to investigate anyone's immigration status that I might choose to. So there's a short guy who kind of talks like a leprechaun in the Minnesota House of Representatives. And if I thought that I wanted to investigate his immigration status, I would have the legal authority to do that under this bill, right?
Chief Allen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I'm not sure, but my reading of the bill is that now that it says that no state or local law or political subdivision, whether acting through its governing body or by initiative, referendum, or any other process, shall enact any ordinance or policy that limits or prohibits a criminal justice agency, peace officer, or official or employee, which I think covers you, from communicating or cooperating with federal officials with regard to information or the enforcement of federal immigration laws and regulations.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So after I do my full investigation of all my colleagues, I think under this bill that I can exchange data with any other federal, state, or local government entity. So if I wanted to email the information that I've collected out to all of my other colleagues who are state employees and maybe the secretaries and legislative assistants, is there anything in this bill that would keep me from doing that?
Chief Allen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, not that I see.
Representative Hillstrom.
This could be fun, Mr. Chair. Just one last thing. Is there anything in this bill that would allow me to compel someone to produce their long-form birth certificate to prove their immigration status?
Or a certificate of live birth. Chief Allen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I don't see that in the bill.
Okay. Just checking.
Sure.
Representative Johnson Cornish last. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chief Allen, I assume that your officers would need significant training to implement this particular bill. Is that correct?
Chief Allen.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, that is correct. It's the process for determining somebody's immigration status is very complex. Those officers who do it on behalf of ICE spend literally weeks in training how to determine that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I assume that in all your stops you'd have to implement this in a racially neutral way, this new data collection. When you did calls on places where you had to go to, you'd have to implement this bill, so you'd have to be ready to go on it.
Chief Allen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, yeah, and I'm not sure how to do that, to be honest. I'm not sure. There's no guidance here how you decide who to run immigration checks on. And so if we did those checks on everybody, it would substantially delay our ability to provide police service to citizens, because every call would take that much longer if we went through the process and we were truly racially neutral.
Representative
Johnson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know the City of St. Paul, they estimated the cost to the City of St. Paul, which is already being cut, proposed anyway, millions of dollars. Somewhere in the neighborhood of $8 million to implement this. Does that seem to ring true with what you would expect for some cost for the City of Minneapolis proportionally?
Chief Allen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I find that a believable figure for the City of St. Paul. I know my friend Commander Martinez is going to testify, and he may have better figures than I. They've done the financials on it. We haven't, but I'm frightened for it. I also think the other financial impact is, I think plaintiffs' attorneys are salivating at the potential of this bill passing, because I think the real expense to us is going to be fending off lawsuits that are created by this bill.
Anything further?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Your testimony is that you have limited resources, and this is just going to further limit your ability to provide public safety in our community.
Chief Allen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, members, the inferences and the references and the suppositions here are made are almost absolutely absurd to apply that there's a fiscal Currently in Minnesota, there's no training given to peace officers in determining whether you're illegal immigrant. I have never seen anything come across in that. I come from a small town of 2,500 people. I have four officers. I would trust any of them to be able to tell. Probably, with my experience, if I get somebody in the car, ask them just a few questions, I can probably tell you 90% sure in 5 minutes whether that person is here illegally or not. It's a gut reaction. It's a lot of things to infer that you have to train somebody to tell if somebody is illegal. And we aren't saying that you have to do this and have to. There's not a mandate. It's just a removal of an obstruction here. And we do this all the time. We've got our preemption laws and our handgun laws where we stop this certain cities from preempting laws. We've also got quota prohibitions against chief law enforcement officers from enforcing quotas. So we step in and say something can be done statewide for uniformity's sake. But it's almost like we have to thank heaven for all the illegal people that are here in this state where we couldn't solve any crimes. To bring this one sensationalized crime up and say that it was solved because we have illegals here, illegal aliens, this whole testimony I find so far-reaching. And I guess my question is, I know officers in your department that say, who are they to tell us how to enforce the law, take away our gut reaction and our instinct? If one of those officers called your mayor or you and asked if they could come here today in uniform and testify in support of this bill, would you let them?
Chief Allen.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Cornish, that would be up to the chief of police and to our mayor. But we as a department have chiefs and a legislative body that we report to who make policy for our department. Our officers don't, and we're a safer city because of that. God bless our cops. We have tremendous police officers in the city of Minneapolis, but their skill is practicing law enforcement, not developing policy. I'm a so-so cop, but I'm pretty good at developing policy. That's why I'm a deputy chief.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Cornish.
It's frustrating so many times. It's like in the Personal Protection Act, we had a lot of officers in Minneapolis that supported it, line officers, union officers that weren't allowed to testify, that felt retribution because they're going to testify. And it's the same thing in illegal immigration. You get the mayors talking through the leadership. You don't hear from the real line officers in a lot of the cases. And to say that we're mandating something and all these horrific things are going to happen and fiscal costs and it's the people come to our country illegally. They take our education dollars, our health care dollars, and now we want to change our whole law enforcement investigation procedures and restrict them from asking the simple, basic questions. It seems like an absurdity why you could be against the law from do this.
Okay, members, we're getting bogged down in discussion and in questions. It's my intent that those people who have come today to testify that they be heard. So we're going to go through Lesh, Hillstrom, and Johnson, and then we're going to take testimony. Representative Lesh.
Mr. Chair, before I ask my question, I ask what other testifiers are on the list? Because maybe it'd be better to save it, be more concise about this.
Yeah. Keith Allen. I'm sorry, I didn't.
Sir, Mr. Chair, which other testifiers we have on the list? We've got Commander Martinez and anyone else?
Captain Hugo will be coming back up. And I think we'll ask again, those in the audience wanting to be heard in support of this bill, raise your hand. Okay, I count three hands. Those in opposition who want to be heard to testify, raise your hands and keep them there.
Okay, well, in the interest of that, Mr. Chair, I will pass.
All right, I've counted nine hands, and I would like to get the testimony. However, Representative Johnson, did you have a question on this recent?
Yeah, well, I guess to Representative Cornish over there, you know, I have thousands of Southeast Asians living in the community that I represent, and it's, from what I hear you saying, you're going to be able to tell by your gut reaction whether these are undocumented or legal citizens. Is that your testimony? If you went to a domestic situation in one of these homes, that your gut reaction would be able to tell you what the status was of these folks and how to best deal with them? You wouldn't need any training or anything. You just, however you feel, you're just going to go with it?
You asked me a question? Or? No, that wasn't mine. I said I could tell within the 5 minutes with some certainty whether they might be or not. I had no determination whether they were or not, but it's your gut reaction that you're taking away. You're not even allowed the officers to ask any questions pertaining to that.
Representative Hillstrom for a question, then we're going to hit the testimony trail again.
Well,
Representative Hillstrom.
Mr. Chair, this is actually about Representative Cornish's comments. You know, Representative Cornish, this isn't just about law enforcement. It isn't just about trained officers and their determination of whether or not someone's legal or illegal. This is about each and every one. My Brooklyn Center is the first suburban community in the state of Minnesota to be a majority-minority opportunity district. What that means is 51% of the people that live in my community are not white. So 49% of the people who live in my community are white. And so this is about every single person who happens to work for any governmental unit in my area being able to investigate any person for any reason on what their immigration status is. And the question we heard from the first testimony was, are you foreign born? Well, a large portion of these people are foreign born. But guess what? Now they're citizens. Now they are here legally. We have a large Hmong population who have come here legally in my community. And so this isn't just about law enforcement and people who have committed a crime. This bill is about everyone. Mm-hmm. Everyone.
Deputy Hugot, would you come up to the table? Chief Allen, you're free to go. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Deputy Hugot, you have to leave too. Come up to the table, if you would, sir. If you had additional remarks, you could go with it, but I'd prefer to get straight to questioning because I know you have to leave as well. Questions from the committee. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You stated in your testimony that the question is, are you foreign-born? So, first my question to you is, you heard me speak that former Speaker Phil Carruthers was born in Canada. He, in the event he came to your jail or someone like him came to your jail, you ask if he's foreign-born, then what happens?
Mr. Chairman,
Deputy
Representative, it's just the process that I speak of here today, and once that question is asked and it's self-reported, if they're a citizen, they continue with the process. Otherwise, it's deferred to ICE, and they continue on from there.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you determine the person is a citizen, or, for example, again, Phil Carruthers probably isn't very happy that I'm using his name right now, but, again, he was born in Canada. He became eligible to serve in the Minnesota House of Representatives, so I'm assuming he was here illegally, and I'm assuming somebody determined that. So now you have someone who is foreign-born. It's been determined by another entity that they're here illegally, and they get picked up and come to your jail. And they self-identify to you, I'm foreign-born. So now, do you determine that that person is a citizen and then call ICE if they're not? Or is everyone who is foreign-born, the sheet gets filled out and ICE figures out whether or not they're here legally or illegally?
Chief Hoggett.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, ICE determines that.
On everyone?
Everyone that's reported.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So now we're in Hennepin County, and this bill allows any governmental entity to investigate the immigration status of anyone. So the people who are in the food stamp area or the child support area find someone that they know now to be here illegally, or they think, and they call your office, Hennepin County Sheriff. I found one. What do you do?
Chief Hoggett.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'm here only to speak on the process inside the jail. I don't have an answer for you.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if someone calls law enforcement in your county and they say, I believe a crime is being committed, don't you have to come out?
Chief Hoggett.
Chair Smith, if I could answer that question.
Representative.
I'd like us to get back to the bill. And with all due respect to Representative Hillstrom, the bill as it sits allows for more communication between the local jurisdictions and federal law enforcement. So the questions kind of imply that one area would be doing all kinds of things by themselves, which is the exact opposite of what this bill is intended to do. This bill is intended to allow for those people who have authority for keeping our country safe work together, each with their own skill sets, each with their own knowledge, each with their own understanding of the facts. So the local law enforcement would be able to work with those federal authorities we want them to make our cities safe.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom, Chief Huggett is going to be dismissed in
That's fine.
3 minutes. So
That's
if there's
fine.
Any questions of him, let's get it out of the way. Representative right. Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, let me start by saying previously I have voted for some of these kinds of provisions. But this one isn't what you said. So I won't be voting for this one, even though in the past I have voted for some of the others. This one is way beyond law enforcement. This is way beyond communicating with federal law enforcement. This is way beyond anything I've ever seen here before. So let me just make that really, really clear. So I just really think that if you're going to say that anyone in government should be able to investigate someone on their immigration status, that we should know what the process is going to be when we find one. I'm done, Mr. Chair, with this one.
Any questions of Deputy Huggett? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this really is, I think, a pretty simple question and for the testifier or for Representative Barrett. Earlier, the term sanctuary city was used. And I'd like to know, is that a term that's in law anywhere? Does that term have a defined meaning? And I don't know if you or your testifier could answer that question.
Representative.
Chair Smith, Representative, I can try to answer that. The term sanctuary city, I think, has been around for quite a few years. If you Google the word or the term sanctuary city, you will find a list of cities that generally have local ordinances that preempt federal laws. That's how that term has been introduced. I know there's another term that some people use as well. Quite frankly, the title, in my mind, is not as important as what goes within that title. I think if you look at, in other words, I don't particularly care what a city council calls it or what a local community calls it. I am more concerned with what people who are trying to get into our country legally term it. And I think if they were to Google this term, they would find sanctuary city, not prohibition ordinance. And they would understand what that means. And that's a place where they could go, that they could be safe from being there illegally. And so what I would like to do with this bill, what I stated initially, is I would like for our state to not be termed a sanctuary place so that possibly people who are illegal would not want to come here.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it was a simple question, but I don't think I really got a simple answer. And let me just, I understand from your answer that this is not an official term. I mean, we can find a lot of things on the internet. People can label lots of things lots of ways. But I don't, from my understanding, there is no legal meaning to the term sanctuary city. And in fact, what you've just said is, I think, your interpretation of what that, what those ordinances do and what they may mean. And I don't even know what ordinances would be considered to fall within that, because I don't think that's an official term. And actually, I would suggest, unless the testifier can help me out and give me a different response to that, I think it's a term that's not helpful. I think it's a term that's misleading. And unless it actually is some kind of a legal description of what we're talking about here, frankly, I don't think it ought to be used. But maybe the testifier can shed additional light on the term.
Chair Smith, if I could, the term sanctuary city, I don't believe is in my bill. So if we not use that term, I'd be happy not using that term.
Chief Huggett, before I let you go, do you have any closing remarks and testimony?
Mr. Chairman, no, I do not.
Representative Johnson.
Real briefly, to Chief again, I wasn't clear on your testimony whether you were a strong supporter of the bill or you were just explaining your jail processes. So just briefly, are you a strong supporter of this bill?
Chief, if you want to answer, go right ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'm here to explain the processes that happen in the Hennepin County Jail, which is what I'm responsible for.
Is that okay? All right, Chief, thanks. And if you see Deputy Ryan Smith, tell him hello. All right. We're going to take testimony for the next half hour, devoting half of that time to proponents, half of that time to opponents. So keep that in mind when you're testifying. 11:30, I will close this testimony and we'll bring it to the table for discussion. So, proponents, whoever wants to start out, let's go. The process is to go, members, I'm going to strictly adhere to what I just said. We'll have testimony for half an hour and then we'll have discussion. And so, sir, if you'd give us your name and then proceed.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Norm Buehler, and I represent MUIR, which is M-U-I-R, Minnesotans United for Immigration Reduction. And we're affiliated with a number of other similar groups around the state. And then by extension, all the states in this country have similar groups. So by extension, I'm really speaking for millions of Americans. Anyways, it's interesting to hear these very myopic, short-term, or what am I trying to think of? It's myopic, and it's tactically, maybe arguably, a good move on the part of the police department to just look at their narrow confines of their authority and what they directly have responsibility for. The sad fact of the matter is that though while maybe tactically it might be a good idea of having a sanctuary zone, although I don't really understand the argument, well, I do understand it, but the if we think about it strategically, it's really a horrendous idea to have some place where the police and any other government workers have a shackle put on them. They are muzzled. And this bill, HF 358, is designed to remove that shackle, Representative Hillstrom. It's not requiring them to do anything other than they don't have to be concerned about being disciplined or fired if they do ask a question like this. The sanctuary zone is an abomination. You get on to, we all here in Minnesota think we don't have any responsibilities for our southern border. But the last time I checked, Arizona, for example, is part of this country. And if we're going to look at this strategically, we have to think of all the states of this country are in it together. And down there in Arizona, as you probably well are well aware of, last year they passed one of the toughest immigration laws because they've had it. They're fed up with the situation that exists there. If you're familiar with SB 1070, the Arizona law that governs this, to my knowledge, it was passed into law. And believe me, they do not allow sanctuary cities. They may have had it at one time. But this is a bad idea. And this flow of illegals into this country is costing us, in the short term, it's costing us billions upon billions of dollars, as previously noted. Governor Plenty said it's costing us $174 million a year in education, medical care, housing, whatever. And it's just it's tearing at the substructure of our society to have all of these people here illegally. And so I urge you to vote yes on 358. It doesn't require that anybody do anything. It just simply removes the muzzle. And I don't know about you, but I really, I, you know, the idea, philosophically, the idea of muzzling public workers, whether they're medical people, police, or what have you, is just anathema to me. Why there should even be such an ordinance is beyond me, but we had it in St. Paul, as you recall, about 80 years or so ago, back in the 30s, when the gangsters of Chicago came up here, and the police department at that time had this tacit arrangement that, well, we won't, well, it's basically don't ask, don't tell, apply to that kind of criminal behavior. But this country faces a severe existential threat of the first magnitude by this immigration. And we don't have to tolerate that. So that's, I could go on, I could show you pictures. I'm well aware of, if you were to do a Google search to...
Mr. Bielor, we do have two more opponents, so proceed directly.
Because we're rolling out the welcome mat here, or at least not coming down hard on people who are here illegally. I just Googled this last night, and it's about border agents shot by illegals coming north, and shot and killed. We don't like that. I don't know about you, but if you vote no on this bill, you are voting for that aspect of it, along with the drug running that accompanies these campesinos and trabajadores, the farmers and workers, the ones I call the innocent ones, but they are a nice conduit for the drug runners and the mean hombres with AK-47s. I listened a number of years ago to the parents of one such border patrolman who was shot and killed, age 27, I think, at the time, down on our Arizona border. That's our border here in Minnesota, too. It's not just Arizona's. Because he came across what he thought were the innocent ones, and embedded in with them were some of these mean hombres, armed to the teeth, and they wasted him. The emotion that attended this hour-long speech by the mother of this young fellow who's now buried in Michigan, it was just so palpable. It was just, it's hard to describe. But the bitterness there, and this process keeps on going because there are other states that figure we don't have any responsibility toward our southern border. I don't know, have we gotten back to the idea of the Confederacy where each state is a sovereign state and we don't have to worry?
Thank you for your testimony. I'm going to move on to another testifier, please.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Sure, thank you. Ex-testifier, step to the table, please.
I wanted to ask him a question, Mr. Chair.
I set the groundwork here. We're taking testimony and then we'll discuss at 11:30.
Yes, thank you very much. I'll try to talk fast and be brief. My name is Linda Hoon. I'm from Minneapolis. I actually live in the Wedge, and I would like to testify in favor of House File 358. I'm also speaking for my husband, Richard Johnson, who couldn't be here today. We believe if we do not have a law such as this, we are moving toward creating sanctuaries, a sanctuary situation for citizens of other nations who reside and work illegally in our country, a place where they can feel a little bit safer, that they will not be checked out, and we thus encourage more illegal immigration. Now, I've been studying issues surrounding legal and illegal immigration for a few years. I know many people who are doing the same thing, so I have been accessing quite a bit of information over the last few years. I'm also an environmentalist, and I am concerned about population and sustainable issues of living in our state and in our country. I think we're kind of on the road to becoming overpopulated in our country. As you saw in National Geographic magazine, we're going to be 7 billion people in the whole world this year, and a lot of them want to come here. Now, I don't need to remind you that in countries that are overpopulated, democracy seems to suffer. So I have concerns that go beyond the state of Minnesota. I think, and I also think, as usual, there'll be people speaking against this bill because a lot of people, because unauthorized immigrants and their advocates are a lot more organized than a lot of us ordinary people. Many Minnesotans are at work, and I know many people who are in favor of this bill are out of town, they're retired, they couldn't make the trip on short notice, so I hope you will consider this. And at the end, if we have time, I just want to read a short statement from someone I know down in southern Minnesota who emailed me his remarks. Now, people who are in our country legal are mostly from Mexico and Latin America. They come here to get something they're not entitled to: jobs, health care, education for their children. And they have advocacy organizations that help them, and that's why they're more organized and motivated than Minnesotans. Most Minnesotans do not watch for these bills. They entrust their elected representatives to be their advocates. So they don't think they have their they don't think they have to tell their elected representatives to please pass a law prohibiting immigration law enforcement non-cooperation ordinances and policies. Like most Americans, they have only one country and give allegiance to that country, as opposed to Mexican citizens, for instance, who live in the United States in large numbers and have two countries. In case you didn't realize it, about 11% of all people who are Mexican live in the United States, and this is reported by the Pew Hispanic Center, which studies all aspects of Hispanic life in this country. Most Minnesotans don't realize many elected representatives are intimidated by individuals and advocacy organizations who will call them racist if they don't vote for it or vote for or against legislation that favors illegal residents. So they are afraid to offend. However, the bottom line is that this is not about pigmentation. This is about behavior. It is about illegal behavior. And by the way, Mexican is not a race. It is a nationality. Latin American is a region. It is not a race. And Hispanic is a loose term that applies to people of a certain language and background, and it is not a race. Many Hispanic people look just like me, and I know some of them. And they're my friends. Now, we have a pretty good country because most citizens obey the law. This is why our system works, and Mexico and some other Latin American countries, which are somewhat lawless in comparison, don't work. It's really kind of a paradox, don't you think, that people break the law to come to a country where obedience to the law has created the conditions that they seek. Have you ever thought that large numbers of people breaking the law in order to live here might undermine and overwhelm our social service system, our laws, and threaten the system we live under? Illegal immigration has already threatened the security of many Americans. Now, ID theft is one of these situations. The Federal Trade Commission reports approximately 9 million Americans have been victims of ID theft. According to a Center of Immigration Studies report called Illegal But Not Undocumented, approximately 75% of working-age illegal residents, and that would be about 6 million people, have committed one or more felonies in order to get jobs in our country, using a fraudulently obtained Social Security number, falsifying I-9 forms, committing perjury, committing identity theft under state laws. Now, children are prime targets of identity theft because until children grow up, they don't have jobs, they don't have credit cards, so they don't use their Social Security numbers.
We have one more proponent. So
I'm sorry?
We have one more proponent, so if you could try to wrap up. Thank you.
Okay. I just want to say, just very quickly, I have personal issues because I've had personal confrontations with people walking through my alley trying to steal my recycling. One of them actually kind of threatened me one time, and I just don't believe that the local government should not cooperate with federal authorities in the way that they have been, because I believe that I would not go through this if there weren't so many people just wandering our streets illegally. So that is my personal reason, and there are reasons of jobs. I work in the hospitality industry. I'm sorry, I'm going to be quick. I work in the hospitality industry. There are a lot of $14 and higher jobs with benefits that I think a lot of unemployed Americans would like to have. You're kind of amending me here, and I will stop, but I just want you to know that there are a lot of reasons to not encourage illegal immigration into our country. And I don't think discrimination comes into into play in this particular law because of the way the law was written, but I think that we need to do something or we will have more of the same. Not all illegal immigrants are criminals, that is certain, but we have enough criminals of our own and we don't need more people who come here illegally. And thank you very much.
Thank you, ma'am. I thought I saw one more hand proponent. If there's a testifier, sir, have a seat, give us your name. And I just want to let you know you have about 3 minutes, and then we're going to go to opposition. Go ahead, sir.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Dennis Holman. I live in New Hope. By way of disclosure, I'm an officer with Rogon, Minnesota, a grassroots conservative political committee, registered in Minnesota, and I hold, as well, positions in the Republican Party. Today, however, before this committee, I speak on my own behalf as a citizen of Minnesota and a citizen of the United States of America. As time is short, I'm going to skip some of this in consideration of the time of the committee. I want to lay out a few facts and figures. It's been estimated that the number of individuals who live illegally in the United States lies between 12 and 20 million. Depends on who you talk to. Nobody is really sure. A 2005 report to our governor, prepared by the Office of Strategic Planning and Results Management, Minnesota Department of Administration, estimated the number in Minnesota alone to be 80 to 85,000. That was in 2004. Comparing population estimates for the years 1990 to 2000, a growth rate of 515% was calculated through 2004. Now in 2011, it is likely, assuming no acceleration in growth, that the population of illegal immigrants in Minnesota is nearly 150,000. This same report estimated the cost to Minnesota, including the burden on public school systems, the added cost of government-subsidized health programs, the expense resulting to our correctional institutions. They didn't even talk about social service agencies. But that the number of those things alone was between 176 and 188 million per year. That was in 2004. As you're all well aware, that the cost of these services has dramatically increased in recent years, it is not unreasonable to estimate the current annual cost burden due to illegal immigration that approaches $500 million.
Mr. Holman, if you could conclude, I would appreciate it so we can move along.
This is approximately 10% of the budget problem that lies before the legislature right now. If it weren't for policies, procedures, ordinances that allowed the maintenance of residents of illegal aliens in Minnesota, our residents of illegal aliens in Minnesota, our budget problem, I would guess, would be diminished. I ask you to vote in favor of this bill, and I thank you for your attention.
Thank you for your time, sir. Appreciate that. We'll now take testimony in opposition to the bill. The first come, first serve. Somebody come to the table. We will have equal time, and that's approximately 17 minutes. Keep that in mind when you're testifying, please. Give us your name and go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
I did see approximately 9 hands, so I'm just going to remind you when you're 2 minutes in, and then you decide what you want to do. Sir, sure. Go ahead.
Okay, when I got 1 minute left, could you do this? Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Bill Martinez. I'm a senior commander with the St. Paul Police Department, and I'm here to speak today on behalf of the City of St. Paul and the St. Paul Police Department in opposition of House File 358. I have a prepared statement, and I've heard comments about how, you know, police departments aren't cooperating with ICE or DHS on law enforcement initiatives. But I'd like to bring your attention that we are one of the few cities that have exceeded those expectations. We've worked with DHS and ICE, and I think Chief Smith testified in an undercover operation that involved human trafficking. We arrested and indicted 29 individuals from the Somali community for trafficking young girls. And I can talk to you about the fiscal cost, and I can tell you about the demand that's going to put on our police officers. But I think I'd like to illustrate something to you that maybe can bring all this together. I'm the commander of the homicide unit, and one of my areas of responsibility is working kidnappings and abductions. On Sunday evening, we get a call that an 8-year-old girl was abducted from the north end on Rice Street. 8-year-old ex-sook, she was from our Corinne community, and she was with her family doing laundry along with about 50 other people in the laundromat, and she was apprehended, taken, abducted, kidnapped by a white male and taken to Spring Lake Park. Our officers responded to the scene, and the witnesses we spoke to, some spoke broken English, some spoke with a broken accent, some we needed interpreters to get information from. But I will tell you this, the information that they provided was critical for us in finding that little girl. We were able to reunite that little girl within an hour to her family. And the other part of that was critical was the information gathered led us to the suspect. And I heard some comments about rank and file officers not liking being dictated how command staff or chief dictate policy. Well, three of these officers came up to me during this investigation and said, you know what, if it wasn't for the trust that community has with us, we don't know that we would have got that information. So I'd like to leave you with this thought. Imagine that was your 8-year-old daughter, your granddaughter, your niece, and you're at the Metrodome, if that's ever fixed, watching a Vikings game, you're at the Gopher Stadium, you're at the XL, you're at the State Fair, and somebody takes that girl, and there's some individual there that the immigrant that may or may not be undocumented that has that critical piece of information that's going to lead you back to your daughter, granddaughter, niece to get reunited, but are reluctant to come forward because of House File 358. So I would caution you that we are opposed to this bill, and this example that I gave you, I think, illustrates that perfectly. Thank you.
Chief, thank you. CCO Radio said this morning it would be July or August when they blow it up. Since they're never wrong, we can trust it. Thank you, sir. Next testifier, give us your name, and I'll just gently tell you when 2 minutes go by. Go ahead.
My name is Virgil Wiebe. I'm a professor at the University of St. Thomas School of Law. I've taught immigration law and immigration clinics since 1999, both at St. Thomas, at Georgetown, and at University of Maryland. I submitted some written comments before Representative Cornish's committee last week, and I won't repeat those. I'll just direct you to those just to respond to some of the statements that have been made this morning. The suggestion that somehow these ordinances in St. Paul and Minneapolis have created a magnet. Jeffrey Passel, who's at the Hugh Hispanic Research Group that was cited earlier, there's a recent study that indicated that in 2000 there were 85,000 unauthorized immigrants in Minnesota, and in 2010 that number had dramatically changed to 85,000 unauthorized immigrants. The same number. I was a little facetious there. The number hasn't increased. The number increases and decreases with respect to how strong the economy is. Undocumented immigrants don't bring the economy down. They respond to it. So if the economy is going well, that increases the flow. If the economy isn't going so well, that decreases the flow. The cost to the state, the governor's report from 2005 was mentioned. In May of 2006, the Office of the Legislative Auditor raised serious questions about that report. For one thing, that report counts costs of educating U.S. citizens as part of the cost. Just this year, the Immigration Policy Center in April indicated a conservative estimate that unauthorized immigrants in Minnesota pay $82 million in taxes, most of those in sales taxes. Another study reported referenced in that Office of the Legislative Auditor report in 2006, it does go back a bit, it cited another study that estimated unauthorized immigrants accounted for between $1.56 billion and $3.8 billion in value added to the Minnesota economy. There's also been discussion of this term, what the term sanctuary means. One of the comments was ordinances that preempt federal law. I don't see exactly how current St. Paul and Minnesota ordinances preempt federal law. I haven't heard any testimony specifically about that because they do seem to comply with 8 U.S.C. 1373. What is different about this law is that it adds this private right of action, and that can put the hands of immigration enforcement, put into the hands of private citizens immigration enforcement. If you go back and look at sanctuary in Exodus, like being at St. Thomas, I sort of have the leeway to look at the Bible and use it on occasion. The idea behind sanctuary cities was to provide shelter from vigilante justice for people who had unintentionally killed someone else. What this bill might do is put into the hands of private citizens the opportunity to sort of create their own immigration policy. And I think that's one of the big concerns that's been laid out by others. I mentioned it in the written comments that I made, and I'd be happy to talk with folks later or answer questions if so called upon.
Next testifier, advance to the table, please. Give us your name. We have approximately 7 minutes left, and then we'll be discussing the bill. Give us your name. Go ahead.
I'll go fast. Good morning. My name is Michelle Garnett McKenzie, and I am Director of Advocacy at the Advocates for Human Rights. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we were founded in 1983 to promote civil society and reinforce the rule of law through human rights. I'm an attorney. I've worked in this field since 1994. I've clerked at the Immigration Court down on the Arizona border, worked in private practice, served as a clinical law professor, and represented asylum seekers in this country. We oppose this bill because it is premised on a fundamental misrepresentation of what the policies actually do, and it jeopardizes the safety of immigrant crime victims by undermining their ability to seek law enforcement protection. These policies were developed by police departments, not by city councils and mayors, to carefully balance two very important policies, cooperating with federal immigration officials, on the one hand, with ensuring that everyone who lives in our communities the freedom to turn to the police when they are victims of crimes or witnesses to crimes. They assure victims that if they report a crime to the police, they'll not be interrogated about civil immigration status violations if they have not committed a crime. The policies help ensure that criminals, whether they're U.S. citizens or aliens, who prey upon immigrants are brought to justice. Nothing stops police officers in our cities, in Minneapolis and St. Paul, from arresting immigrants who are suspected of committing crimes. Upon booking, as you've heard, their country of origin is recorded and they're turned over to Immigration and Customs Enforcement for removal determination. Separation ordinances do not place a restriction on law enforcement officers' ability or authority to arrest people who are suspected of committing crimes. They don't restrict their authority to ask for identification and arrest people who fail to identify themselves or establish their identity. They do not place any restriction on the authority of officers to investigate immigration-related crimes or to ask about and record country of birth. If you read the ordinances that are in place, none of those activities are restricted. And in fact, the ordinances specifically authorize local cooperation with federal immigration officials on joint criminal investigations. There is one thing they prohibit. The only thing law enforcement officers are not authorized to do under these policies is to question, arrest, or detain persons for violations of federal civil immigration laws. That's it. And they can even do that when immigration status is an element of the crime or when they're enforcing federal document fraud penalties. Thank you. We know fear of deportation too often prevents immigrants from seeking protection from law enforcement. It impedes an effective government response to crime. Crime victims in our community have a right to seek protection from the police and safety and access to justice.
the policies that are in place help our communities strike a very careful balance on two complicated issues, protecting our communities and cooperating with federal law enforcement. By enacting this law, you erode their ability to strike this balance. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next testifier, please come to the table. Give us your name. And when 2 minutes go by, I'll just let you know. Go ahead, sir.
Hi, I'm the Reverend John Gutterman, Covenant Minister at the United Church of Christ New Brighton and the Immigration and Policy Advocate for the Twin Cities Based Interfaith Immigration Coalition. I'm here because of personal experience has called me to be an ally and advocate for immigrants. I am here because of the text from Leviticus, the alien who resides with you shall be to you as the citizen among you, and I am here because I was a victim of a recent crime. My father was a carpenter. One of the things he told me about hammers, he gave me the hammer rule, that not every job needs a hammer. The corollaries are you need the right tool and the right person and the right fix. A few months ago, my house was broken into, causing some $4,000 in damage, and several thousand dollars of our possessions were stolen, including my mother's wedding ring. If an immigrant, documented or undocumented, saw that crime, I want that person to come forward. Passage of HF 358 would make that less likely. HF 358 is the wrong tool for the wrong people, and it's not the right fix. I want police solving my crime, not cross-questioning potential witnesses about their immigration status. I believe police are our friends. HF 358 tells immigrants police are not their friends. The right tool is federal legislation. The right people needed to create that tool are in the United States Congress, and the right fix is comprehensive immigration reform. I urge you as a committee to set aside this legislation and advocate for bipartisan reform. Thank you.
Reverend, thank you. Next testifier, please. And I'll gently remind you when 2 minutes are up. Give us your name and go ahead.
Great. I'll keep it brief. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Eva Benavides Clayton, and I work for Casa de Esperanza, a domestic violence organization in the Twin Cities with a nearly 30-year history of providing critical services to victims of domestic violence and their children. I am here to express Casa de Esperanza's opposition to House File 358. Our board of directors and staff are very concerned by the proposed legislation recently approved in the House Public Safety Committee. We urge you not to support this bill, which would have a devastating impact on efforts to provide safety for victims and build the kind of trust and communication with local law enforcement that is critical to reduce crime and protect all communities. Federal law guarantees that all persons, regardless of immigration status, may access services necessary to protect life and safety, including shelter, emergency medical services, and victim assistance. However, passage of this bill would have a chilling effect, causing fear and confusion among immigrant populations. In our work, we often see how abusers use a victim's immigration status as a tool or weapon of that abuse, causing the victim to fear deportation or losing custody of her children if she seeks assistance or calls the police. It would also cause fear among witnesses too afraid to come forward to cooperate with police for fear of being questioned about their immigration status. Additionally, immigration laws are highly complex, requiring extensive training for those tasked with immigration enforcement. When local police and other local city officials who are not trained on immigration laws can question and report individuals they suspect of having unauthorized status, this opens the door for racial profiling and often creates fear and mistrust even among those with legal immigration status. We therefore urge you to oppose passage of House File 358. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We have time for one more testifier. Step forward. Give us your name.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Tao Mei Shong. I'm with the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. I'm the public policy specialist for the coalition, and we represent 83 member programs throughout the state. I'm here because our programs serve a large number of battered immigrant women who come from all over the world to escape violence. Many battered immigrant women come to our programs with unique and complex barriers, and some of those barriers are limited English ability. They don't understand American culture and American judicial system, and also they face a lot of isolation because they don't have family members or friends here. Because of that, I'm here to oppose House File 358 because it would discourage battered immigrant women from calling the police and seeking safety. For battered women, the police are the first line of defense in domestic situations. Battered women need to feel safe calling the police for help when they are in danger. Immigration-related policies and practices that directly hinder a battered woman's access to law enforcement creates a dangerous and ultimately deadly situation, because what policymakers and the general public do not realize is that many of the batterers of immigrant women are citizen spouse or legal residents of the U.S. The batterer who is a citizen or legal resident uses his legal status as a means to control, manipulate, and exploit the immigrant woman by threatening her with calling immigration, not filing her immigration papers, or hiding her legal documents, just to name a few tactics in which are used. Our programs report that they often see batterers who intentionally force women to go out of legal status in order to maintain control and power over her. And I just want to give you an example from one of our member programs. A Cambodian woman named Hip came to a shelter after her husband had abused her. Since she came to America, she came here on a fiancé visa. He forced her to have sex with him several times a day to the point where she couldn't walk. He would often beat her to the point to where she was dizzy. I just wanted to cite that example because the reason why she stayed in this situation for so long is because she didn't understand any English. She came here without friends or family, and she was completely dependent on the batterer. So I highly recommend that you please vote no on this bill because it would be detrimental to immigrant battered women. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank everyone for their testimony. Chair closes testimony at this time, returns the bill to the table for discussion. Members will take 15 minutes to discuss the bill, and then I intend to see this to a vote. Discussion. Representative Cornish.
Just real quickly, first of all, if anybody here from Hennepin County, thank Sheriff Stanek for coming in and testifying and have enough guts to stand up for something without fear of being labeled a racist or anti-immigrant. Next, the foreign-born thing that people are blown out of proportion. When you fill out a form for a firearm nowadays, you almost get the glove treatment. Any form you fill out nowadays, anything to do with government, ask your sex, your age, your medical status, all sorts of personal questions. It would only be common sense that you would ask if you were foreign-born. Just statistical data, so get wound around the axle, big deal if you get asked if you were foreign-born. You get asked about every other aspect of your personal life for financial assistance. And finally, the question that begs to be answered in law enforcement is gone, is if you make a traffic stop, and we won't pick any on any race, you don't get labeled a racist, but say somebody has a foreign accent, and when they drop their billfold, several IDs fall out of it. As you all know from my previous legislation, you didn't want to make it illegal to possess multiple IDs, so there is really no crime committed. So you got someone in your car that's nervous, that has a bunch of IDs, and now you don't want the cop to be able to ask their country of origin or their immigration status. It's just one of the ways that you're muzzling law enforcement from just doing their job. Now you're saying they can't do part of it, and it could result in a crime being, you know, prevented. So I just wanted to thank Representative Barrett for your excellent bill and your courage to present it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple comments on the testimony. I've been at two committees now, this is the second committee, and I moved with empathy for the illegals who find themselves in a situation where they're being exploited or whatever. But it's one of the reasons that I support the bill. And what I mean by that is, you know, we've heard the negative and burdensome effect that it has on our society, whether it's our schools, healthcare, government, or criminal justice system, and also the connection with illegal drugs. But really, when I look at the situation, I see that the illegal immigrant themselves are the ones that put themselves into a situation where they can be exploited. And therefore, by strengthening our laws, and I see Representative Barrett's bill as strengthening the law in terms of being able to enforce our immigration laws, we send a deterrent to more illegal immigrants coming up here. I would encourage those who oppose this bill to get involved and come up with a system so we can bring guest workers and bring legal immigration here. In other words, bring people here, because we're all immigrants in the end, and we need immigration. It's been a tremendous blessing to this country, economically and otherwise. But let's come up with a system where when these people come here, they're not put into a situation where they can be exploited. And when they come here illegally, that's what they do for themselves and their families. So, and a lot of that has to do with the federal government not enforcing our federal immigration laws. So, that's one of the reasons I'm supporting Representative Barrett's bill, to strengthen the laws to provide a deterrent for more illegals coming here. And Representative Barrett, I want to again echo Representative Cornish's comments. I appreciate you coming forward. I find you to be a person who wants to resolve this issue and create a better situation, not only for our society in general, but also for the illegal immigrants themselves. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Shemansky.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I had a couple of questions for law enforcement. I don't know if we have anyone left in the room. Otherwise, I may ask Representative Cornish to just give me a little background. But when an officer encounters anyone, they generally ask for a personal ID. Is that correct?
Representative Cornish.
Yeah, you have a right to ID him, yes.
Okay. Is it a crime to possess a false ID?
Representative Cornish. No, it's not unless you present it as it's you or if it's someone else. You can have as many false IDs as you want as long as you don't use that ID. So as long as the one you produce is legal and it's you, you can have 10 false ones laying right in the seat and there's no crime.
Representative Schmanzi.
Representative Cornish, if a person is here as an immigrant, legally they would possess a green card or a visa. Is that required, in the encounter with law enforcement?
Currently, I think there's 75 different visas that you can have in talking to ICE, different qualifications of resident and non-resident and all sorts of educational things, but you would have to have, you would have some documentation, you would think. You don't have to have it on your person unless you're in a certain status, but I'd have to research that one.
Representative Schmanz.
Final question, Representative Cornish. If informants come forward to law enforcement, are they required or asked to provide identification to assist law enforcement in investigating a crime?
Representative Cornish.
No, and in fact, the example that was giving you, I can't imagine somebody coming up in the Metrodome to report a crime and the first thing a cop says to him, what country are you from? That was the most ridiculous assertion I've ever seen.
Representative Schmanz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, there's so many problems with this bill, I don't even know where to start, but I'll just be brief. I mean, it goes against local control. We've heard from our folks in Minneapolis and St. Paul, which it seems to be directed at, that it's not something that's needed. It's unnecessary. The system works as it currently is in place. It certainly isn't fiscally conservative because it's going to cost the cities who are already being cut in their law enforcement funds a significant amount, even more money. That's a big problem. It's going to take away from duties that they've already prescribed to do. So thanks for that. And job number one, I know I've heard you speak to this, Mr. Chair, more than once, is for government is public safety. That's what we want to make sure we take care of. And we've heard from the professionals that this goes in the opposite direction. It detracts. It takes away. It's a problem for public safety in our cities. Why anyone would support that, I have no idea. So this is a big no on this bill. And, Mr. Chair, I would like to amend your motion of sending it to the General Register, if this is a good time to do that or not.
Yeah.
Or do you want to wait?
Let's conclude our discussion, okay. And then I will entertain your motion.
Thank you. That's it for me, Chair.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really just want the record to be accurate, and I want to make it clear to everyone that this isn't just about law enforcement being able to check on your immigration status. This is about any government entity. That means me, that means you, that means the legislative assistant, the committee administrator. So if any person who came before this testifying table wanted to give their opinion, they're in a public building, and I would have the right to investigate their immigration status. That's what this bill says. It isn't just about law enforcement. So I want to make that real clear on the record. Second, I want to make it real clear on the record that Sheriff Stanek's testifier said they were talking about the status of what they do. They were specifically given the opportunity to endorse the bill or to not endorse the bill, and they did not do that. So their testimony was about the process. So I want to make sure the record is accurately reflecting they did not come forward and say Hennepin County or Sheriff Stanek supports this bill. So I have previously supported some of these bills that allow law enforcement to do their job. This one isn't that. And so I want to make it really clear that this is far-reaching. Again, if I wanted tomorrow, once this becomes law, the very next day, if I wanted to investigate every single member of the Minnesota legislature's immigration status, I would have the legal ability to do that. If I wanted to email every single state employee about that immigration status under this bill, I would legally be able to do that because it wouldn't stop me from emailing that or communicating with other government entities, right? That's all of us. So anybody who testified, no matter where they were born, no matter whether they were white or non-white, I would have the ability to investigate their immigration status and share that with all of you. That's what this bill says. So I don't know if that is your intent, but that is what the language says. I'm finished, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Johnson, get ready. The chair renews his motion that House File 358 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to amend that motion to send it to the Rules Committee. The reason being this particular bill didn't meet deadline in either the House and Senate. There's not a Senate companion. It didn't meet the policy deadline in the House. So if we're going to have any sort of protocol for following institutional rules that we've set up in the House, this it certainly should go to Rules Committee.
Any further discussion on Representative Johnson's motion? Hearing none. Those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no.
No.
Motion does not prevail. We're back on the original motion. Any, excuse me, further discussion? Hearing none. On the motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
We're going to bring back, Chair will bring back House File 868, Representative Szymanski's bill. Representative Szymanski moves House File 868 be recommended to pass and be referred to Ways and Means. Representative Szymanski, you have an oral amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
That oral amendment would be to align the bill with language approved in House File 211.
Bring your own order.
211 as amended. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion does prevail, and the amendment is adopted. Any further discussion or presentation?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House File 868 is the changing the limits on conciliation court. This is one of those peace in the valley kind of amendments to this bill. Both the opponents and proponents have come to the compromise agreement that changing the limits to 10,000 and 5,000 is agreeable to both sides, and I ask for the committee's approval of this bill.
All right, Representative Szymanski, thank you. Any discussion? Hearing no further discussion, Representative Szymanski renews the motion that House File 868 is amended, be recommended to pass, and be referred to Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Okay, let's thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We are adjourning to 1 p.m. tomorrow, or subject to the call.
All right, members. My intent at this time to adjourn until 1 o'clock tomorrow on Friday, May 6th, or subject to the call of the chair. Any questions? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is that or to the call of the chair today or to the call of the chair tomorrow?
I think once we're done today, tomorrow.
Okay.
Short answer. All right. Meeting's adjourned. Thank you.